Good. We're going to go ahead and get started again. And we're moving on to the general prophylaxis and wound dehiscence section. The first measure is that we'll be discussing is 528, and that will be discussed by Dr. Collins.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So subject matter pretty near and dear to my heart here. The first is 0528, which I believe is a SIP measure number 2 up for re-endorsement. This particular measurement is the surgery patients who receive the correct prophylactic antibiotics consistent with current guidelines based on their procedure. And the procedures listed in our packet are CT surge, vascular surgery, colon surgery, hip and knee arthroplasty, and vaginal and abdominal hysterectomies are listed. There's a comment about an appendix, however, I didn't see that for other procedures. But I know that other procedures such as neurosurge and other procedures are being rolled out as we go. I think this is a very important measure. Selection of the appropriate antibiotic, I feel goes without saying, as well as the importance of not selecting agents that are too broad from a collateral damage standpoint. So not only is there good evidence for, based on the antimicrobial susceptibilities, but also the spectrums of the agents. So I do think it's important, and the work group did as well. The science behind it, I think, is pretty appropriate. Some of the justification for antibiotic selection listed in our packets, I don't feel was very rigorous. The Stanford guide and the Johns Hopkins antibiotic guide were listed as justification for selection of a couple different agents. However, I know there's a technical advisory panel that reviews selections quarterly, I believe. So the scientific rigor, I think, is good. However, I do think there's a measure to harmonize and continue to harmonize with national guidelines as they come out, which I think CMS is doing. The work group thought it was very usable and feasible as well, with compliance greater than 95%. So points of discussion, I assume we'll go into the bundle discussion as well as whether this measure is tapped out. And I'll turn it over to the group for discussion.
Anybody want to start? I would just comment that looking at the literature, it seems like there's the closest correlation between this measure, selection of antibiotic, and surgical site infection as compared to the timing measure. So I think this is a stronger measure than the timing.
This is, or can I, the developer, make a quick comment?
Sure.
So I'm just going to make a couple of quick comments about the three measures, and then I'll go back on mute. The three measures that are being considered: selection, timing, and discontinuation. First, the measures, all three, actually are strongly evidenced, and in new guidelines will be published this year through four different specialty societies. The three majors are still strongly enforced in the new guidelines that are going to come out. They're the evidence. There still is opportunity for improvement in all the majors. I mean, if you look at national rates, they've gone up dramatically, but by different surgery types, there are some variations. Finally, I actually would argue the point that was just made about the strength of evidence around antibiotic selection versus timing, and I can't go into all of the details right now, but there have been a spate of articles looking at different measures, trying to show whether or not they're associated with the patient outcomes, and I will simply say that most of those patients have some fairly large methodologic flaws. The biggest of it is they try to use performance rate published on hospital care to predict outcomes at the hospital level, something you really can't do because that approach doesn't take into account all of the exclusions from these performance measures. And then we're in the edit process right now of a very large study of all the population for 3 years that shows you definitely want to go to a hot passive measures if you're eligible to measure. So I'll just say that there's
well, Dale, your voice is kind of going in and out. Is it possible to make him a little bit louder? And I'm not sure exactly why that's happening, but I just want to make you aware of it.
Okay, I'm getting big feedback sometimes when I speak. So I'll just end by saying that there's strong evidence base for all three majors. All three majors will be strongly supported in new multi-specialty society guidelines that will be coming out this year. Those societies include Infectious Disease Society, SHEA, Surgical Infection Society, and the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. The four societies have been working now for the last couple of years on the new guidelines. These three majors are all consistent and strongly supported in the new guidelines. And finally, we have really good patient-level data adjusted for the hospital effect, all the appropriate risk adjustment methodologies that show that at the patient level, you want to be in a hospital that passes these measures. The measures are associated with improved patient outcomes in contrast to some of the papers that have come out that have had strong, substantial methodologic flaws. So more will be coming on that soon.
Thank you. Paula, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, my question was, again, where laparoscopy is in the exclusion criteria, and I think we've talked around the table about, with the trends in surgery, that that's a concern.
I think, Wanda, you're on the call. Haven't we removed the laparoscopy exclusion?
For January 2012, it will be coming out.
So we've addressed
it. Right.
Could you repeat that?
We have addressed that issue. In January of 2012, the specification manual removes that exclusion.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments, questions? Dr. Morton?
I think I speak in support of the measure. I think the appropriateness of antibiotics is pretty critical. I think the question about topping out is probably still there and whether or not it fits within a composite, but certainly we want to give the appropriate kind of antibiotic. And before some of these measures were in place, there was a wild, wild west about which kind of antibiotics were being used. So I think it's a very useful measure.
You know, and a point of clarification, too. I was referring to individual agents within the submission here. I'm very happy to hear that the national, you know, kind of core group guidelines will be factored in to the SIP initiative for antibiotic selection timing and such. I know those are coming out. I believe anticipated publication is around September of those guidelines. So as a whole, I was referring to just the individual choice of, you know, maybe a specific agent, not the overall choice.
Are we ready for a vote? Okay. So, importance to measure and report. We can say yes, none say no. For scientific acceptability of measure properties. We can say completely, we can say partially. Usability. Oh, 16 say completely, 2 say partially. Feasibility. So 16 say completely, 3 say partially. Does the measure meet all of the NQF criteria for endorsement? He can't say yes, none say no. Apparently we also should permit the FTS and the AFC to introduce their measures. This is a daily opportunity. So we'd like to invite the FTS and then the AFC to introduce their measures before we proceed to them.
I'm Jeff Jacobs from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, and I think it's clear in the packet that there's three antibiotic-related measurements that STS has put forward that are bold measures that have previously been reviewed. One's related to appropriate choice of antibiotic, one's related to timing, and one's related to the length of antibiotic usage. There's extensive justification in the peer-reviewed literature for all three of these measures, including manuscripts written by the STS Evidence-Based Task Force that discusses the level of evidence to support each one of these three measures. And I don't think I really need to go through those in great detail because that's all supplied in the packet.
Just to reiterate, yesterday we did try to harmonize with the skip measure for the IV antibiotic timing.
Okay, so the next measure is measure 128, duration of prophylaxis for cardiac surgery patients. Dr. Kleinfeld will be presenting this.
Great, thank you. This is measure 128. It's duration of antibiotic prophylaxis for cardiac surgery patients. It's a maintenance measure. It was first released in 2004. The measured steward is STS. With respect to this measure, we actually looked at the categories. Obviously, it is important with respect to prolonged antibiotics and the percent of antimicrobial resistance. With respect to scientific acceptability, I think our group had the most discussion about this because of a timeline of 48 hours versus 24 hours. And Connie, unfortunately, she's not here, but with her involvement with respect to the Infectious Disease Society, she actually brought forth some references for us, and it was interesting to look at some of those. With respect to the development of these guidelines for cardiac surgery, it was developed originally by the American Society of Health Systems Pharmacists, and they identified that expert opinion was a driving force with some respects with this timeline of 48 hours. So we really questioned going back and forth 24 versus 48 hours with respect to the evidence for scientific acceptability of this measure. Some of the other things we noted within itself, there are some denominator exclusions listed, but we noted that their exclusions could not be captured in the previous version of the STS database. However, it was indicated that the new cardiac surgery database, which was released this January of 2011, will enable exclusion data to be captured, and so that is forthcoming. We noted that disparities of care were provided. For the most part, there still is a gap ranging from about 83% to 100%, but the mean is around 94% itself. And there are no direct costs, it's indicated with respect to the measure, but really no specific information about costs involved in maintenance of this measure. So I think for us, the areas of controversy, again, was really along the timing and the evidence that supports that. Now, you did tell us that there was some forthcoming guidelines from the other societies, and I'm not sure to the degree to which they will give us more information on the issue of timing with respect to cardiac surgery antibiotic prophylaxis.
You know, I can comment on that. The upcoming guidelines, which I have seen the draft, recommend 24 to 48 hours. They say the evidence is inconclusive for one or the other, so they do allow that range.
So I guess with that in mind, does this mean when we see it again next year that this might be changed then to 24 to 48 hours, or can the measure developers speak to that?
I think that there's very limited experience of doing cardiac surgery with only 24 hours of antibiotic prophylaxis. And the risks associated with an infection after heart surgery is probably worse than after most operations because it's mediastinitis, which generally leads to death. And I think that prior to making a society-based recommendation of changing the length of antibiotic prophylaxis from 48 hours to 24 hours after cardiac surgery, I think that topic would have to be studied in greater detail in cardiac surgical patients. The evidence base in the literature simply does not support changing prophylaxis for cardiac surgical patients to 24 hours.
And I have to say the same thing kind of exists for some vascular patients. You know, again, for just the risks associated with being wrong is a graft infection, and graft infections can lead to limb or life loss. So we have a similar issue going on in vascular surgery patients.
So I would say it may be very reasonable to ultimately change this to 24 hours, but I think it's very premature to do that now because it's simply not been studied.
Also, I mean, you know, the reason for 24-hour coverage is that's theoretically when the skin seals, but if you look at, like, older people with very loose, you know, kind of yucky skin, they don't seal at 24 hours. So it may be actually more patient-specific than has ever been looked at.
We'll get into this in another topic, but orthopedics is a similar problem with major implants and risk for infection and the 24-hour range. There's no data one way or the other, so it's been selected at 24 hours for majority of surgeries, cardiac surgeries excluded from that for some reason to a 48-hour window. There's a question, should we be consistent across the measures?
Any other questions or comments? Let's go ahead and vote on this measure.
I just want to make one. The guideline is going to explicitly recommend less than 24 hours for all operations based on no good evidence of prolongation being useful. So, just a point of note.
I'm not sure we heard that comment, Dale. Could you repeat it?
As said, the new multi-specialty society guideline is explicit of less than 24 hours for all operations, no exceptions.
That must have changed since public draft comments then. Is that correct?
I don't remember exactly. It's been quite a while back that the draft was out there, but the guideline is explicit now that less than 24 hours for all operations. And actually, for almost all types of operations, there are studies that have looked at single-dose prophylaxis. I think STS a number of years ago, when they chose 48 hours, made that recommendation based on the fact that there weren't studies that compared 24 to 48, but they're actually limited studies of single-dose prophylaxis, even in cardiac surgery. I think our emphasis is much more in the guidelines on doing the upfront things right, correct dosing, correct antibiotic, redosing in the OR, which have all been shown in fairly good trials to reduce infection rates. And part of the big push on antibiotic stewardship is to reduce unnecessary use of antibiotics.
Okay, we'll ask for the remaining comments about measures that are not their own to be held until the public and member comment period, unless it's among the committee and people who are the developers of the comments that are being discussed.
Can I respond to that from FCS?
Sure.
I would just say that I want to reiterate what I said before, that ultimately it may be appropriate to change cardiac surgical prophylaxis to 24 hours, but that the evidence base simply does not exist in the literature.
Yeah, you tell us that. Thank you. Let's go ahead and vote on this measure unless anybody on the committee has anything else that they'd like to say about it. Okay. Does the measure meet interest criteria for importance to measure and report? Eighteen say yes, one says no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. 10 say completely, 6 say partially, 2 say minimally, 1 says not at all. Usability. Thirteen say completely, 6 say partially. Usability. Eleven say completely, 8 say partially. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Seventeen say yes, 2 say no. The next measure we're going to bump back up again to Dr. Collins, 126, selection of antibiotic prophylaxis for cardiac surgery patients, and this is the STS measure, 126.
So yeah, this is a measure very similar to 0528 from CMS. This is selection of antibiotic prophylaxis for cardiac surgery patients submitted by the STS. The numerator is the appropriate choice of antibiotic denominator number of surgeries to meet criteria. Patients must receive either first or second generation cephalosporin or vanco or a fluoroquinolone if there are allergies or contraindications there. Much like 0528, the work group felt this was an important measure, scientifically acceptable. It's been active since 2007, so I feel it's both usable and feasible as well. The issue of whether it's topped out could come up again at 92% compliance on this.
Anything else on the committee? Questions or comments for the developer? You made a comment previously that meatus sinusitis leads to death, so that's a pretty extreme sequela of inadequate coverage. So something I guess that we should think about in terms of being topped out is 92% actually topped out for this measure. I guess in my opinion it's not, but I'd be certainly happy to hear anybody else's opinions about that. Okay, should we go ahead and vote then? This is a quick discussion. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? Nineteen say yes. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Fifteen say completely, 4 say partially. Usability. Seventeen say completely, 2 say partially. And feasibility. Can say completely and one says partially. And lastly, does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Nineteen say yes, none say no, none abstain. The next measure is measure 125. Timing of antibiotic prophylaxis for cardiac surgery patients, and this is going to be introduced by Ms. Zambricki.
Hello, everyone. My measure is the percent of patients 18 and older undergoing cardiac surgery receiving prophylactic antibiotics within 1 hour of surgical incision or start of procedure. The importance to measure, I think the summary of the evidence regarding deep sternal wound infection is very strong. Our group had quite a bit of discussion about, is there evidence of a link between the measure focus and the desired outcome is that link strong? Because that's one of the criteria for implants to measure. And I think there's controversy about that. It sounds like there's a new study coming out. But the idea that exactly 1 hour before incision and 1 hour and 10 minutes is not acceptable, 1 hour is acceptable, I think there's some controversy about that in the field. What is the exact timing that is necessary to have a link between decreased surgical site infection or not? And there have been some studies recently that show that that link is not a powerful link, but it sounds like there are studies coming out, so it's just a tough issue, I think, right now, that importance to measure for us. The importance to measure section by the sponsor for the rating of strength of evidence, they left that blank and put not applicable. For the is there controversy, they left that not applicable, so they really did not address the issue of the rating of the evidence. In terms of scientific acceptability, the exclusion laparoscopic is still there, but we understand that that is going to be taken away. It was interesting because they do include patients for whom no incision is required, but make an exclusion for patients with laparoscopy. So that's, it would be interesting to hear the explanation of that thinking. But in terms of the testing, I guess I should go back, the importance to measure. I think there's a real question about whether a gap exists for this measure. The median performance is 99.2%, and the mean is 98%. So it seems as though this should have consideration as far as being a topped-out measure. Testing, there was no data on exclusions because there was some type of a database change with FTS. They said that that would be provided in future years. And in terms of usability, there's a lot of similar measures, so the idea of harmonization is an important one. And I think that question of is there distinctive, improved, or added value, the supporter said not applicable, and I think that gets back to the question about the controversy in the literature.
Anything else from the committee in terms of questions or comments for our developer?
Sorry, Christine, I didn't quite understand the issue of an hour versus an hour 10. Is the controversy with respect to that specific timing or some variation in timing?
Well, I think the overall controversy is there a connection between the skip measures and decreased surgical site infection for individual skip measures? And there is recent literature in JAMA and others with large patient populations at the VA. There was 60,000 and JAMA, I think it was 400,000 patients, or it may have been vice versa, showing no correlation between individual skip measures, of which this is one, and decreased surgical site infection. I would say in the field, and I'm interested in what the surgeons think, but in the field there is a lot of, credibility problem with surgeons who get dinged for, because the case is delayed, now they haven't met the skip measure, and ask, well, does this really make a difference in infection if it's 15 minutes late or if it's 1 hour? So I think that's just kind of background noise in the field as far as a credibility issue. But in terms of the literature and the exact time interval, it's kind of, there must be some time interval that's important, but it is not conclusive. And I know Connie's not here for infectious disease. She had presented with some data that was quite dated, but it did suggest that 30 minutes might be appropriate. So is it 30 minutes? Is it 1 hour? Is it an hour and a half? Is it 2 hours? It seems like there's controversy about that.
There's no controversy.
I would also say maybe even longer would be needed. In fact, we have a PharmD with us, but, you know, getting tissue levels, you don't have tissue levels for some antibiotics in an hour.
And it's not even an hour because it's within an hour. So people sometimes will bring the patient in the OR, push it in, and it's gone in 4 minutes
right.
before.
And
so
you haven't gotten skin tissue levels.
Yeah.
Because the volume of distribution may be, and especially in the obese patients where the volume of distribution is high.
Yeah, I would concur. It's absolutely variable by antibiotic, and by procedure. The data, I think, is very good for extended periods of time administered very much too early, or even within 15 minutes, there's harmful data there. It's difficult to, I see the discussion of exactly 1 hour versus 1 hour 5 minutes. I see why that is a discussion point. I don't know. I'm not sure of a better way to go about it, though. I think 1 hour has been studied, and I don't know if I have answers on this.
I agree with Curtis. I mean, it's a tough one to figure out if 1 hour is exactly right or if it's 30 minutes, but you got to set a goal at some point, and it's the goal that's been set, I think, through compromise. And there's a lot of old data to show that, you know, the antibiotic does get into the tissue around that time. I know that people are trying to have to game the system to some degree, you know, as long as you do it before the incision, but it's a start. I don't know how else to do it other than to refer back to the developer and say that, you know, you need to have a better idea of when the antibiotic is actually getting into the tissue. Regardless of those studies that came out, I'd like to hear from the developer, because I've heard some mention earlier that there were some methodological concerns about it, that there were a lot of exclusions that were associated with those studies, and to get a better handle on what they think the scientific validity of those studies are.
Jeffrey, would you like to respond to that?
So what I'd like to do is just read two sentences from the measure submission form to clarify exactly what the recommended timing is based on specific antibiotics, and then I'll move from there to addressing the question. We say that in patients for whom cefazolin is the appropriate prophylactic antibiotic for cardiac surgery, administration within 60 minutes of skin incision is indicated, parenthesis, class 1, level of evidence A. And then we go on to say, in patients for whom vancomycin is an appropriate prophylactic antibiotic for cardiac surgery, a dose of 1 to 1.5 grams or a weight-adjusted dose of 50 milligrams per kilogram, IV solely over 1 hour with completion within 1 hour of skin incision is recommended, parenthesis, class 1, level of evidence A. And the reference for these two is a manuscript that was published in the Annals of Thoracic Surgery by the STS Evidence-Based Task Force. In this particular manuscript, the first author is Rich Engelman. And this is a task force that spent a substantial period of time reviewing all the literature about antibiotic prophylaxis and came up with consensus-based recommendations, including class and level of evidence. So I think that these recommendations, they are, first of all, made on an antibiotic-specific strategy. And second, there is a level of evidence provided here. Clearly, it wasn't filled out in the appropriate place on the form, but it was placed in this location. And this level of evidence came from an expert panel reviewing multiple manuscripts and multiple studies about this topic.
Can you tell us what was the year of publication from that citation?
This is April 2007, Annals of Thoracic Surgery, which is the most recent multi-specialty evidence-based medicine review of the literature that's been undertaken and published.
So the supporting data is from an expert panel that reviewed the existing literature?
Everything that had been published up through that time. And the reference list of that is substantial. It's massive.
Any other questions or comments?
Let's go ahead and vote.
I would
ask one question. That is the performance, 99.2% and 98% mean, 99.2% median. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think that if I was having heart surgery at a hospital that did 500 cases and I was one of the two patients that missed that and ended up dying of mediastinitis, I'd feel real bad. It's a very high-stake game, and I think that this 99% isn't acceptable for this, because if 1% of your patients die from this, it's a big problem.
Any other comments? All right, let's go ahead and vote. Importance to measure and report. Well, 17 said yes, 2 said no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties.
Elaine said completely. Eve said partially. Usability. A 13 said completely, 6 said partially. Feasibility. Okay. 15 said completely, 4 said partially. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Yeah. 17 said yes, 2 said no. So now we'll move on to measure 264, prophylactic intravenous antibiotic timing. And this was to be presented by Steve Finley, but instead he has comments that will be read by Alexa. So I also ask for the people who are present on that work group telephone call to please chime in even more than usual.
Performance on this measure has been above 95% for 5 or more years. On the work group D call, there were questions about the requirement that antibiotics be given within 1 hour rather than 1 to 2 hours or so. Doubts about the strength of evidence for 1 hour. So discussion of that and questions to the steward should be prompt. That was the main issue. The city's disparities data is not collected or available on this measure, so even though it looks topped out, since there is now a routine practice, there still may be a need to preserve the measure. Scoring on the measure for usability, science feasibility was all C or P, and importance to measure and meeting the criteria. The stewards, as they did yesterday, are likely to argue that this is a key measure for them. Personally, I think the measure is close to topped out, if not there already.
Any other comments from folks who are present on the work group call?
Well, I know we did have some discussion with respect to the fact that there is no data on disparities, so I think that's something that we would look to have the measure developer provide, if any of that data is possible. We also had some discussion with respect to the definition and the issue that it says on time, and then the clarification of on time is within 1 hour of incision time. So it was questioned, well, couldn't that just be put into the statement instead of saying on time, say within 1 hour of incision time, because then it's clear. That's semantics, I guess. But that did come up in our discussion as well.
Okay. Would the AOC like to respond to that? We can definitely add the 1 hour to the instead of on time. If you think that's clear?
Yeah, it makes it just more clear. Then you don't have to go to the subscript information and all that. Okay. So, great. Thank you.
In what ways is this different than the skip measure, other than it's outpatient?
I don't know that it's different, other than we look at, instead of procedure codes, we look at all patients who received an IV antibiotic prophylaxis. It's less burdensome for collecting data from ASCs. And again, to the issue of topped out, we've got about 900 out of the 5,200 reporting right now. And again, right now we do not have disparity data because it is not mandated, but once it is, we will.
Anybody else want to comment about that?
I think I would advocate, just based on that alone, that this should be retained then, even though it is top, you know, the scoring is high. We just don't have that information on disparities, and you indicate that it's really a sub-portion of all the centers that are providing this data.
Okay. So that's for the developer to change the language a little bit regarding clarifying what on-time means. Let's go ahead and vote on the measure. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? One can say yes, two say no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Ten say completely, two say, nine say partially. Usability. Try to say completely, seven say partially. Feasibility. Thirteen say completely, six say partially. And does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? You can say yes, one says no. The next measure is 527, prophylactic antibiotic received within 1 hour prior to surgical incision. This is a skip measure being presented by Ms. Van Bricke again. This is another in a series of antibiotic timing measures and also makes the exception for 2 hours for vancomycin. I'd say the only thing different with this measure is that the compliance is 97.1%, which is a little different, a little lower than the cardiac surgery measure. So I think it raises the question of whether this is tapped out or not, 97.1%. A lot of improvement in the last 9 years. When it was first measured, it was 55.7%. So that's a lot of change. And I think the questions regarding the timing are still the same questions as they are for the other measures.
Are the exclusions the same as in the other CMS measure?
I could look back and see that.
It said C.
I think it still is the laparoscopic. I'll look at it while everybody's talking about other things.
Well, the reason I asked, actually, because I missed this the first time I was reading the other measure on the prophylactic selection. Is that they actually have as an exclusion those that did not receive antibiotics. So I wondered about that.
Yeah, these exclusions are length of stay greater than 120 days, hysterectomy and C-section, preoperative infectious disease, performed entirely by laparoscopy, enrolled in clinical trials, physician, advanced practice nurse, physician assistant, documented infection prior to surgical procedure, procedures requiring general or spinal anesthesia that occurred within 3 days prior to or after the procedure of interest, receiving antibiotics more than 24 hours prior to surgery, receiving antibiotics within 24 hours prior to arrival.
This is Dale. I can answer that question about that one specification. If the patient did no antibiotic, they fail the measure on antibiotic timing, but because we assess, you know, antibiotic choice, they are excluded from the antibiotic choice measure. So they fail one, but they don't fail both. It's to avoid full jeopardy on a measure.
Is that clear to everybody? Does that answer your question? Okay. Any other issues that anybody wants to raise?
I was just wondering about the
laparoscopic procedure for this sponsor.
Dale, has that been removed, and can you also address that question about whether this should be considered top down?
Yeah, so the laparoscopy exclusion has been removed also, so for all of the skip measures. I guess it depends on how you define top down. There is variation between surgeries. So, you know, you heard earlier that cardiac surgery has high rates of performance, but I can tell you the rates of performance for general surgery are lower. So it does depend on the type of surgery. There is a variation between types of surgery. I don't have the disparity data, though. I actually think WANDA has provided or can provide it. But there is some variation between different types of surgeries.
I guess I would argue against this being tapped out for the reasons we've heard and the importance of this with the other procedures as well.
Any other thoughts about that among the group?
I'll just say, looking at the disparity data, there is a fair amount of disparity based on age, geographic location, and things. So while the overall numbers might look topped out, it looks like there's a fair room for improvement in quite a few places. And in fact, you probably don't want to live in the U.S. territories looking at all the disparity data for the skip measures. So if you're going to Guam, be careful.
Okay, let's go ahead and vote on this measure. Place all importance to measure and report. Nine can say yes, none say no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. I can say completely, 6 day partially. Usability. Four can say completely, 5 say partially. Feasibility. Eight can say completely, 1 says partially. And last but doesn't measure meet all the NKF criteria for endorsement. You need one more vote here. Seven can say yes, 1 says no. Okay, so there we are. The next measure is measure 529, prophylactic antibiotics discontinued within 24 hours after surgery end time, and this will be presented by Dr. Klintel.
Right, 529, prophylactic antibiotics discontinued within 24 hours after anesthesia end time, with the exception that it's 48 hours for cardiac surgery. It's a maintenance measure. It's been in use since 2001. The measure steward is CMS. With respect to this measure, obviously we've indicated the importance in terms of antibiotic therapy before, and discontinuing within an appropriate timeline. With respect to scientific acceptability, you know, again, the issue is that there is evidence, obviously, about prophylactic antibiotics. Connie had raised the issue, however, that there is some, but not a lot, that single-dose prophylaxis versus 24 prophylaxis. So, again, that whole timeline is still, we don't have the evidence to substantiate what is actually better for patients. She actually indicated there should be a movement for no post-operative antibiotics prophylaxis, as there isn't evidence that supports any post-op prophylaxis. And again, that's from her perspective from the Infectious Disease Society, but she's not with us to further expand on that. So we did have some discussion with respect to that. We noted that the exclusion still listed laparoscopic procedures, so we wanted clarification on whether that was removed. With respect to other aspects, we noted that the national average is 95.5%. However, there still is a gap, particularly with respect to disparities of care. It's about 88.7% with Hispanics. So therefore, obviously, it's continued importance in terms of monitoring. In terms of usability, it currently is in use for the Hospital Inpatient Quality Reporting Program under CMS, and it's also part of the SCIP measure set. We did have one issue with respect to feasibility. It's indicated that the specifications, which includes coding and data elements, are modified every 6 months, according to feedback provided by clinicians and hospital staff collecting the data. And so we were wondering how this really, how these potential modifications of specifications every 6 months is communicated to NQF and stakeholders, and how it's expected that may affect performance rates from quarter to quarter. So that was really our only other additional point. Connie also highlighted there were no studies performed on cost of implementation. It was an additional comment that she had as well.
Any other comments? Dr. Collins?
Yeah, I don't have many comments. I think we did a nice job of summarizing there. I think I would. The 24-hour mark is pretty standard for this measure, and I would concur about looking at further data, shortening that duration when possible if the data is there.
Just from a practical standpoint, I think this is not met. Most of the time this is not met is because there's a small delay in administration of the antibiotics. So it's it's 25 hours. A lot of these drugs are Q12, Q8. Mm-hmm. So that last dose is right at, if people give 24 hours of antibiotics, which frequently they do, maybe it's not necessary, but that's still built into a lot of post-op protocols. That last dose is right on the edge. And so a lot of the times this is not met because of a nursing administration, pharmacy, delivery, patient availability issue rather than a quality of care issue regarding this. So now maybe that should lead people to give, 16 hours or 12 hours or something. That's another issue. But, I don't think we should change it. It's pretty standard now, but, you wonder if 26 hours or something like that would have been a better, time frame in terms of the numerator rather than strict 24 hours, but it's just a comment.
I think what you're describing here is more of an annoyance than anything else. Like Dr. Morton pointed out earlier, we have to have some target, and you're sort of saying that too. Any other comments or questions? Okay. So one of the interesting issues for me that came up in the preceding measure was that we've seen a real shift in hitting the measure from 55.7% to 97.1% over a long period of time. One of the things that hasn't come up with some of these maintenance measures is, have they had an impact? It has come up for some, but not all of the measures. Have they had an impact? And it's certainly something that I think we should be paying attention to. Is this doing anything? So there was a question about evidence of a quarterly change in performance, I think. Did that come from you? Okay. And so we'd like to ask CMS to address that, and also the laparoscopy question as with the previous measures.
And I think it also goes back to what Christine was saying, that are we actually affecting the endpoint, which is the patient?
So this is Dale. I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but so across the board, the laparoscopy issue has been addressed in January 2012. So it's out of these measures. Remember that this measure is not about impacting infection rates, because when you look at all of the published studies that have compared short-duration antibiotic prophylaxis to long-duration or single-dose to long-duration, the outcomes for virtually every single one of those studies is the same, that surgical site infection rates are no different. Prolonging antibiotics doesn't lower infection rates. It certainly doesn't increase them, but it doesn't lower them. This measure is about antibiotic stewardship, stopping the use of unnecessary antibiotics. So in terms of measuring an outcome, it's one of the flaws in some of the studies that have been published that have been mentioned earlier that are looking at composite skip measures. This measure has never been shown in clinical studies to impact infection rates, and so it doesn't make sense to have it in a composite that's looking at, you know, reducing infection rates. So this is, I think, maybe one of the best performance measures that we've ever had in the country related to antibiotic stewardship, because as noted earlier, the national performance on this has gone from 55% to 95% over about 8 years, a dramatic reduction in unnecessary antibiotics.
I have a scientific question. I agree with you. This is about antibiotic stewardship. And I was wondering, is there evidence that there is benefit to reducing surgical site infection with any antibiotics once the wound is closed?
Well, I would argue that there is some experimental data that showed that there's a short period of time after surgical closure that the wound is vulnerable. So I never argue with a surgeon if they want to give a single dose at the end of the case, or I think, there's a theoretical concern that wound contamination could occur. Beyond the immediate postoperative period, I've never seen any studies that show convincingly that you can reduce surgical site infection rates by continuing antibiotics, and yet we know from a number of studies that you can increase the rates of C. difficile colonization, and in the cardiac surgery literature at 48 hours, the only paper that looked at less than 48 versus greater than 48, when an infection occurs in a patient, I want to highlight again, the infection rates were no different, less than 48, greater than 48, infection rates, surgical site infection rates were no different, as has been shown in all studies. But when an infection did occur, those patients that had received more than 2 days of antibiotics had 60% increased risk of a resistant organism. You just select out, colonize the patient with resistant organisms. So we strongly think that this is an important measure, and we're actually, I think of all of the accomplishments of SCIP, this may be one of the most important.
How does in vascular surgery, we have a lot of patient procedures that are not 100% clean because there's like a gangrenous toe. And I have to say, I always get coding those patients appropriately in terms of clean, contaminated. I don't know where they fall in, and how do those kind of cases weigh into your 24-hour antibiotic rules?
Yeah, that's a real good question. So if there's documentation of infection before, during, or after the operation within 48 hours for most operations, 72 hours for cardiac surgery, the case is excluded from this performance measure. And Wanda can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe gangrene that's documented actually is considered documentation of infection, recognizing that sometimes it's just ischemia, but those cases would be excluded.
I believe that's correct, and I know we've gone round and round with abstractors on this, but gangrene is considered an infection.
So the case is not included in the denominator for this measure.
Okay. Anyway.
I think he makes a great point. This isn't about preventing surgical site infection. It's about appropriate use, and I think it's pretty critical because we've seen C. diff rates go up over the last 10 years, so it's an important measure from that point of view.
Okay, and do you want to add another comment to that?
No,
From an antibiotic stewardship standpoint, too, at least, you know, in our institution, this has had a big impact, and I feel it will and has nationwide as well, really cutting back on durations of therapy, which, you know, can extend for too long, which puts patients at risk. So I concur with the impact that this has on antimicrobial stewardship and stewardship practitioners across the country.
Yeah, and I would say not only that, it's about resource utilization and cost. So you've got nursing administration costs, you've got pharmacy preparation costs, extra tubing, all of that the healthcare system somehow, some way pays for. And so irregardless of the other issues, that's also one of the big issues with this, and that's another reason that this is a really important measure.
Okay, let's go ahead and vote. Does the measure meet any criteria for importance to measure and report? Okay. 19 say yes. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Four can say completely, four partially, one minimally. Usability? Eight can say completely, one partially. Usability? Can you say completely? Can you say partially? Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Nineteen say yes. Next, we'd like to open the floor to NQF member and public comment. And I thought that we had given some time for a member and public comment last night, but apparently there were some. There was a member that would like to comment about the discussion from yesterday as well. Anybody on the phones for a member and public comment?
Star 1 to signal. That's Barbara Rudolph from the Leaf Frog Group.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to make a couple comments. The first one relates to some of the ARC measures that were voted down, and I just want to remind the committee that these measures are being widely used in at least about 20 states. These types of measures are being reported publicly. And
I'm sorry, could you speak a little bit louder?
The measures, I wanted to talk a little bit about the ARC measures that were turned down yesterday in the vote, and just sort of remind folks that these measures are being widely used not only by state health data organizations that publicly report information, but also by state Medicaid programs and state public health programs who rely on the state hospital discharge data and utilize the ARC measures. I think it's important to think about the widespread use of these measures and the fact that most entities that public report today only have access to state hospital discharge measures or data sets. So when you think about things like 30-day mortality, you're really limiting the ability of entities to measure, because the only party that can actually do that is Medicare, because they're the only ones that have enough cases to be able to actually use that 30-day measure, and where they have information because they have the longitudinal data. So I would strongly urge you to consider not merging and not pairing the 30-day and the inpatient failure to rescue measures, because that would essentially mean that there would be no public reporting. So please consider the use part as well as some of the other components. My second comment relates more to the continued use by CMS of the clustered hierarchical models, where they're using random effects as the estimation as opposed to fixed effects. And there's been some recent research that shows that when you use those kinds of random effects models, you essentially focus on specificity rather than balancing sensitivity with specificity. And the difference there is you end up protecting hospitals and not providing any good information for either consumers or purchasers. And if you look at the CMS reports, you'll see that out of 4,500 some hospitals, you have 5 or 6 or 7 who are above average and an equal amount are below average. And that really gives absolutely no information. And I think it misleads the public in terms of saying that these hospitals are okay because they've been pulled to the average by the estimation techniques. So just something to think about. The most recent articles by Kipnis and Escobar and Draper, and it's in Medical Care, the May 2010 version volume. So those are my comments for today.
Thank you for your comments. A couple of things that I wanted to just clarify. One of the measures that you discussed, measure 351, which was the ARC death measure, we discussed that adjacent to discussion of the failure rescue measures. And just so the committee understands, we did not vote that down. We voted in support of that. I'm sure that this will come up for further discussion. We voted in support of the ARC death measure.
I was actually addressing the discussion for the competing measures at that point. Rather, I know you had discussed yesterday potentially pairing them or just harmonizing them to the 30-day and eliminating the inpatient. So I would be very, I guess, cautious about doing that because, as I said, there's so many groups that are currently publicly reporting those and who don't have access to 30 days. And you're also limiting the population then, since Medicare only addresses the over 65. So for commercial payers and others, the inpatient measure is very important.
Bob, it's Melinda Murphy. The discussion about pairing or linking them was a discussion that was made by the developer. The committee has not had that discussion, and it will have, as you said, the three measures will be discussed whenever there's the discussion of related and competing measures.
Okay, actually, I have one more comment. When, there are competing measures, for example, I don't know if you're going to discuss the survival predictors or not, but I really wasn't aware that there was going to be this discussion. We don't have our developer ready, so if there's a possibility, if that's going to be discussed, I'd like to ask for an extension.
Related and competing measures with respect to those measures that have been discussed yesterday and today will not occur today. Helen's going to give us some background and a bit of setup for that, and then we'll actually convene a conference call to talk about related and competing measures, and all of the affected developers will be notified in advance and invited to that meeting.
Great, thank you.
We'll start the discussion today, Barb, but certainly the detailed discussion we'll have on a subsequent call. We'll make sure you have sufficient notice to get your developers in line. The one measures we will talk about today, because the developers will be here this afternoon, are the pediatric heart surgery measures.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Is there any other public and member comment? Helen, would you like to
to frame out the discussion of the related and competing measures that will occur after lunch?
Sure. So briefly, we do have still those two additional measures. Patrick will be back. With that. We have not done the postoperative wound assistance yet, right? There's two additional measures still to do. Patrick will be back this afternoon. I emailed him to see if he can get back sooner. But the other thing we'd like to do today is actually just at least look at the measures that are before you, and I believe you have a table that outlines for you the measures that are at least we would consider related or competing. We also provided for you the guidance that we've put out for comment recently, specifically on our guidance of how you would even begin looking at related and competing measures. And so would turn your attention to those documents. Is this easily findable on the thumb drive?
It would be in the materials for the May meeting. It'll be in that PDF.
Yeah, I couldn't.
It's the materials that went out on April 26th with the 8 attachments, and it's attachment 5. And I'll put it up here on the screen.
Okay. No, we're talking about all of them.
So the surgery steering committee material PDF that has 9 attachments, and attachment 5 is related and competing measures. That's the table. It starts out with the memo. You scroll down, you see the table.
Great. So this is basically just offering you an approach. And again, this is not it's not a new criterion. Over the last couple of years, we have always had committees do related and competing measures. The two big differences are, one, for the first time, you will actually, because of this new endorsement maintenance process, have all the measures put together in the same project. So you have the chance to look across the measures and see whether one measure is superior, whether another measure is superior. But the key thing also is when there are more than one measure, in a given area, when is it okay to have them coexist? When do they need to be harmonized? And if so, what's involved in harmonization? So we've tried to just give the steering committee just more guidance overall to specifically help you with that decision making. Could you scroll down to the part where you get to the nice flowchart for us? Keep going. All right, let me just stop right there for a second. So the first question is determining whether there's actually a need to see if there's an assessment of competing or related measures. So we've kind of done that for you by laying out for you which measures we believe address, as we've defined it, competing measures, the same concepts for the measure focus, meaning the target population, process, condition, event. The example, we've talked about several of these, like failure to rescue over the last couple of days. If you then go down to the next, can you pull up that page there? Perfect. So here's where we really look to your input and your insights. So we would ask you to, all these measures that you're going to be looking at have now been deemed as being ones that meet all the NQF endorsement criteria. So that's the first lens. We don't get to related or competing until you get through that first step. The key thing then will be to look at some elements of each of the criteria to help you make that first assessment. So the first one impact, opportunity, and evidence relates to the importance to measure and report. And in this instance, we would see if, for example, there's any differences there. Is one measure superior, for example, because it may provide a broader patient population, a bigger opportunity for improvement, for example, scientific reliability and validity. Well, we can actually pull up your ratings to see if, in fact, you think there were differences in one being more highly reliable, valid, and precise than another one. And then all else being equal, our preference would be that when we can, we want to get to the measures with the broadest possible applicant, the broadest possible population who could be measured. So there are some instances, for example, where there are measures that may be Medicare only, or measures that may be, a very narrow population. The preference would be a measure that allows the maximum number of people to use the measure for reporting. Usability, this is an important one, because this is where it actually gets at how usable it is for the accountability functions. Can people actually get those data and use them for public reporting? That was the exact issue Bob just brought up for us on the telephone, for example, that, in their experience, the ARC measure is more usable because the end audiences have had access to that measure, have used it for years for public reporting, and have found it useful, in addition to how useful is it for quality improvement. And that's where I think a lot of the discussions you've been having today about this is actionable, this isn't actionable, would come up, and we'd ask you to take a look across the two of them. In terms of feasibility, if there's two related measures and one has significantly less burden on the data collector to do it, that would be one to consider. But again, we want to try to move towards where we know the puck needs to go, so we want to move towards measures that will get us closer towards EHRs. And sometimes, for example, a claims-based measure where you work now, but maybe a registry-based measure could work in an EHR environment to follow. So it's not a clear-cut split, meaning claims always win here. And then finally, if a competing measure doesn't have clear superiority, and unfortunately I think a lot of the time we wind up being in this bottom bucket, this is where we would ask you to look to see if there's a justification for multiple measures in a given topical area, and really consider whether the added value of having those two measures offsets the potential burden. The potential burden in terms of confusion, the one you guys talked about earlier, in terms of I do this in a hospital, I don't do this in the outpatient side, but also to get at the issue of whether you then wind up with confusion if people have different scores on different measures, or if you think about this moving towards a more high-stakes payment model, would you have clinicians and hospitals ranked differently depending on the measure that's selected? So those are the kind of pluses and minuses that we would ask you to weigh. And in general, one of the things we've tried to do is point out that when we can, we would like to try to get to the measure that gets us to, as I mentioned, the broadest possible population, and when you want more than one measure, justifying it. So again, one thing to consider is you may have a registry-based measure in front of you, you may have a claims-based measure in front of you. You would need to consider, first of all, are they equivalent? Are they really rising to the same level on each of those criteria? And then at the end of the day, do you see added value that you could justify by saying the world as it is right now could actually live in this world of having both of those and justifying it? So that's what we'd like you to think through. And that's it. So we'll walk you through this. Again, this is very new. We literally just closed comment on it about a week ago. You guys are forging a new path for us, as cardiovascular did as well. It's not a new criterion. It's really just that we're trying to give you as much as we can sort of some decision trees to standardize our work across committees, sort of like the exercise we went through on competing, which we're now writing up the flowchart for based on this discussion this morning. So that's what we'll do. We're not going to get through all the discussion today. I think what we'd like to do is for the competing measures, particularly for the developers who are here this afternoon on pediatric heart surgery, to hear from the developers the differences between the measures. That's a little bit of a unique situation. We had two measures that came through a pediatric heart surgery project that we just did, one from Children's Hospital of Boston, one from STS. At the end of the day, the steering committee couldn't make an assessment of which they thought was superior. It went to our CSAC, and their feeling was, well, the third measure that's competed is in your committee, so this would be the logical place to have this committee not have to reevaluate the first two measures. That's been done, but to at least give an assessment of how the measures look when they compete head-to-head. Is there a consideration for having more than one of those, more than two of those? Are there questions you would pose back to the developers? We're not going to ask you to make that decision today because we've just provided you those materials in the past week, but at least as we have this discussion, to have you lay out what are the key questions you would want to ask the developers. Is there additional information you would like the developers to come back with? And at times, are there things that two of the developers could do together to bring their measure together, for example, as another option? So I'll stop and see if there's questions. Yeah.
The term harmonization has been used multiple times, I think, for different purposes sometimes. And sometimes we think, well, that makes two similar measures and put them into one. I don't think that's how this is being used here. It seems that it's more looking at the definitions, the numerator, denominator, the data that's collected, and trying to make that as similar as possible, in part to relieve the data burden. Is that, how should we be thinking about the term harmonization? How should we use that in our discussion?
It's an excellent question. When we're talking about harmonization, we're talking about where there is the same measure focused, but perhaps different patient populations. So an excellent example is the exercise you just went through about the ambulatory surgery environment versus the inpatient surgery environment. They've got different data sources. It's got to be, by definition, a different measure to allow us to capture that data. But at the end of the day, we've got to be making sure the science is consistent, the way the measure is constructed is consistent. That's harmonization. At times, we do actually have examples of when two measures can in fact be put together into one. We just did this recently. It's somewhat painful. Takes a long time. But for example, we had a measure that already existed doing cervical spine films for patients with trauma, what the indications were. We then had a measure submitted that said CAT scans for patients with cervical trauma. I said, wait, this will create the wrong incentives out there if there's two. So instead, those two developers decided to work together and actually came back to NQF about 6 months later with a combined measure of CT plus cervical spine and MR. We've been doing some work, for example, between the American College of Surgeons and CDC on two competing surgical site infection measures, which, given how high-profile SSIs are, the idea of sending out to the universe two competing surgical site infection measures just did not seem optimal. So they have now been working for more than 6 months on trying to bring those measures together. So there are examples of both. When we're talking about competing, we're really saying same patient population, same process of care identified. Sometimes they're on different data sources, different data platforms, which might be one reason to consider. And even if you decide to put through competing measures and say there's justification for both, if they're really on the same population and they're really looking at the same measure focus, that's where harmonization comes into play. We don't want things defined slightly differently so that you wind up with apples and oranges, even though we know we may get very different rates of performance when you change the data platform. And I think we're just going to have to live with that for the next X number of years until we all move to the, we hope, the electronic, interoperable electronic platform.
I think it's time for lunch then. Right now it's 11:55. Is Patrick going to be here at 1 o'clock? Okay. We want him to be available.
Right. We need him
to
be available.
Yeah. No response yet, right, from him. Okay. Let's say 12:45. We'll come back. Everybody get that? 12:45? Okay. Measures to discuss prior to moving into the next part of our meeting. And this is a continuation of general prophylaxis and wound dehiscence. The next measure is 367, postoperative wound dehiscence, to be presented by Dr. Seema.
There are two of them. I'll just discuss them both together because they basically come up. It's basically the same template. It's just one's a pediatric, associated with pediatric patients. One's the other one's adults. Going reverse and back in the order, feasibility and usability, no one had any questions about that. I'm glad Dr. Romano provided an updated reference. It is clear that using administrative databases that you're able to identify these cases quite readily and that they truly are what they are, by and large, for the most part, what they say they are. They are wound dehiscences. So usability and feasibility, I think no one had any concerns about. Whether we really got, where the real issue hit the road was whether a measure to be reported and also the fundamental underpinning of reporting it. What I was most struck by, and I hope this is simply a clerical error and not an attempt to use the data in a way that may not support it. The summary of evidence of the reason for doing this is referenced in all throughout the paper on one paper from 1989, and I just want to read it. It says, based on a two-stage review of randomly selected deaths, Cannon et al. Reported that cases with a secondary diagnosis of wound destruction were three times more likely to have received care that departed from professionally recognized standards than cases without the codes, 4.3% versus 1.7%, after adjusting for patient demographics, degree geography, and hospital characteristics. And basically, that is the rationale for doing this. Given the profound nature of that, I actually had that paper pulled. And unfortunately, there is no separate analysis based on wound dehiscence. The actual data is based upon cases with an infection and or wound disruption reported as a secondary diagnosis. So there is no separate analysis based on wound dehiscence. Therefore, the statement there is incorrect. Furthermore, when they say that it's just did from recognized professional standards of case of care, I'll quote from the paper's authors, in addition to the three targeting criteria that were not significant for other quality of care judgment, wound descriptions or infection was also not significant. So the papers and authors also said. So what this really led us down to dealing was is that the justification for this, the scientific justification and the whole rest of the thing that flow from it are not supported by it. Furthermore, further analysis and also in the paper provided by Dr. Romano talking about preventability of the event. In a review of the literature, basically the vast majority of the literature would say that this is a non-preventable event. It's related mainly to non-modifiable factors such as morbidity, age, diabetes, obesity, underlying liver function, disease. And in this paper, Dr. Romano so kindly provided this morning, if you look at the post-op wound dehiscence rate, non-preventable ranks at 25% of them, uncertain of what caused it was 41%. So that's consistent with what's in the literature of somewhere between only 20 to 25% of cases have anything that they can say is a possible modifiable factor. So the scientific rationale for it, and everything, especially the rationale that it's a huge standard of care problem, is not supported by the literature. As far as the demonstration of performance gap, looking at over the extensive amount of data that was provided, the estimate is anywhere on range, particularly about 1 to 3 events per thousand, with it being higher and much in the older age population, which is consistent with what we see in the literature, but it's certainly not a modifiable factor. There's no real disparity data. This is cited and provided by the developers, but there's no real difference in disparities. Again, it's mainly tied to somewhat into age and possibly underlying diseases. The data cited for on disparities mainly goes more to the methodology as opposed to specific to wound dehiscence. So the methodology does show that there is differences in PSI based on disparities, but there's no specific data related to wound dehiscence. And then finally, other than this updated version, the data, there's some issues about what's in and excluded and in. This is supposed to be only abdominal pelvic surgery that is reported, and in the document as presented, there's things like inguinal hernia repairs and stuff like that are presented, which really would dilute the things. But I think the more recent analysis of the PSI and some of the more improvements that have been made to it clearly show that it's a valid measure and a reliable measure. So really the main issue just revolved around the scientific underpinning here, the rationale for it, is there an opportunity for improvement? But the other ones, certainly the methodology and everything is top-notch. So that was the only difference is one's a pediatric and one's not.
Anybody else in the committee with questions, comments about this?
Sure.
Measure?
I have one comment, one question. The fact that right now we think that most of the causes of this are unpreventable doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't measure it. in my opinion. 15 years ago, we thought central line infections were unpreventable, and so on. And there's countless examples of that. So measuring it might provide an impetus to find ways to prevent it. But then the more specific technical thing, I spent many years working in a trauma center. We do a lot of damage control procedures. We deliberately leave abdomens open on a fairly frequent basis, and then obviously come back and reclose them at some later point, which as far as I can tell from reading the numerator and denominator statement here, those would count as misses on this, and that's incorrect.
That actually is a coding standard, and it depends on how it's coded in the institution. So if the institution knows that it was a patient that was left open, they don't count, they don't code it the same way. I explored that with our coders, and they said there's a way of differentiating that. Although that was one of the initial issues with the PSI 14, from the way I understood it, the coders were not distinguishing that, and people who are intentionally left open, such as cardiac cases where the chest was left open, those were being coded, but that's been apparently remedied. I can't speak to that 100%, but my understanding is there is a way of differentiating on the codes.
I think the points that you brought up in general about the validity of this as a quality measure are crucial to understand. So let me just make a few comments about 6-7 and realize that I may well be biased in my interpretation of this. But we don't know that this is a problem in the surgical care of children at all. There is absolutely no literature. And what I'm worried about is the classic case of having cited that article, as you said, which was just sort of cookie-cuttered all the way through. It's a case of, children are not small adults. And to take or to extrapolate an article from the adult literature and say it's a problem in the pediatric surgical literature is or in the pediatric surgical care, I think is totally inappropriate. In addition, this is an incredibly small complication. And that's the problem. I don't think we can't even pick this up in our NSQIP data right now in order to be able to discern performance differences within institutions with the incredibly small numbers that this is going to be, at least pertaining to this one metric. And so, as I said, I'm concerned about the small numbers, and it's also it's going to be a tremendous data burden. The denominator is way too big. They've got way too many procedures included in it. So I have serious concerns about the validity of this metric right now as a quality measure in children's care.
When you say a very infrequent event, are you referring to pediatric, adult, or both?
Pediatric.
I'd like to comment on a frequency even in the adult literature that was accompanying this measure. The rate was less than 2 per thousand, and out of that, one of the studies identified 66% of those were not preventable because of patient conditions. So I'm not sure you could say the 998 that didn't have it were providing quality care because they didn't have a dehiscence. It's just such a small number of occurrence. And then over half of those aren't preventable and aren't an indicator of quality, so 1 in 1,000.
I'm a little concerned about that number. I think that it should actually be a lot higher, which makes me wonder if the capture is inadequate here. Any of the other surgeons or clinicians want to speak to that?
At least in our hospital.
This is from the developers. If I could just address one point on the 66% for the preventability on the pediatric measure.
I'm sorry, who's speaking, please?
I'm sorry, this is Cheryl Davies from the RQI team.
Okay.
So that study was done with a previous definition, and so wanted to just note that also included some staged procedures, and that's why they were included in the non-preventable category. And since then, we have now excluded some of those staged procedures. Now, that being said, we don't have enough detail about that study to know exactly how that would change the preventability ratings, so we're not able to give an updated number for that, but we suspect that a good chunk of those were staged procedures that are now excluded from the indicator.
Could I address the other questions? I'm sorry.
Sure, but anybody else on the... So I asked a question. Any other clinicians find that number to be a bit low, 2 per 1,000?
I come on, as our institution, I would agree with you that our reported number is less than what everybody clinically thinks the incidence is. So I think the true incidence is probably higher. And it's a vagary of coding, at least at our place.
I deal with poor protoplasm. I'm certain our incidence is higher. But we also have a lot of procedures I'm not sure how you'd score. You know, the wound partially opened at the bedside. Pack, that kind of
there,
thing.
There are some classifications on this. This is fascial dehiscence, so not wound disruptions and stuff. And that's where one of the initial coding issues was wound disruption versus fascial dehiscence. This PSI is fascial dehiscence that requires reoperative closure. So I've personally looked at every single one of these in my institution and then correlated it with other measures, our OR schedule and stuff, and found it to be very close. And our rates are about this number. If you use that definition, wounds that are opened in the ICU and left open are not included in this PSI. So it may be, you know, vagaries of the coding, as Alan says. But I don't see this number being much higher than, well, at least in my experience, is higher than what this is. And, you know,
yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's dehiscence and there's dehiscence. And, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon for the fascia to separate a little bit and have a little bit of fluid. You never have to do anything about that. It's the ones that you have to take back to the operating room that are probably the ones that are more actionable when you think about it. That being said, especially if you're talking about an elderly population, the risk factors for dehiscence are going to be a lot higher as well. So, I mean, I think if you use a very strict definition, it's probably more reasonable than, I think, Arden, what you're talking about is the number probably is higher when we think about just from dehiscence, but even at the fascial level, but it's the actual number that you actually have to reoperate on is a different subject, and that probably is more the smaller number.
Well, I agree with Bob. We look at all of these as part of our professional practice evaluation committee. We look at all the PSIs, and we actually look at these when they come up, and it's been pretty consistent. What the PSI reports is what we see in practice.
So I guess the question then is this measure, are there enough events to actually measure with this? And it sounds as though the thinking is that they're not necessarily preventable. Those few events are not necessarily preventable.
Just one overarching comment here. These are intended to be patient safety indicators, so they are frequently very rare events. So there's not necessarily, when it's a safety issue, I don't think there's necessarily a threshold for how many is enough. Again, it's a claims-based measure, so it's not something for which there's a lot of data burden to collect. And the question is, for each of those events, you know, what are the downstream implications for that patient, and are there learnings that happen at that hospital as a result of knowing that?
The issue is a safety event implies that you can alter the course by doing something. The vast majority of these you cannot, so is it a valid patient safety event? I mean, that's why one of the complaints against this one is that it is an event. Should it be say that an institution that has an event is not safe? That's not the point of and we're not asked to do that here. We're asking, is this a quality measure that's important to measure and report, and is it scientifically valid?
Just another point. If I recall from the demographic data, there was a slight increase in the rate in academic medical centers, which I think brings up the point that the patients, many of us could predict what patients are going to dehisce, you know, people with bad tissue problems, vascular, just sick patients. And I think a lot of those patients get sent to academic centers. So it's possible the better surgeons take care of the patients can actually have a higher rate because they are getting the referrals of these sick patients to their facilities.
Could I address? Yeah.
Sure.
This is Patrick Romano representing AHRQ. So I think I can address almost all of these comments. So
So first of all, the data burden is zero because the data are already collected in the routine course of hospital activities. In terms of the coding issue, yes, this code is specific for wound disruption. So if a hospital is using it in cases that were left open deliberately, that's incorrect coding. In the paper from the VA, it's at your seats, you can see that there was a positive predictive value of 87%, a confirmation rate. When you look at the false positives, 7 out of those 15 false positives were cases where the abdomen was intentionally left open. So there is some degree of miscoding. What we found, of course, is that as coders learn how to use the codes and attend to it, that this problem goes away. In the pediatric study, I call your attention to Table 2, it's a little bit tricky to read, but the numbers for postoperative wound dehiscence, there were a total of 102 cases in the children's hospitals that participated in this study, but only 52 of those were reviewed. So for 3 or 5%, they found a coding error. That's in the third column of numbers. And then in 5 cases, or 10%, they found that the event was actually present on admission. So again, it's about 85% that were confirmed. Now, then to the preventability issue. So they reported that 34% of the events were preventable, according to retrospective review of the medical records in the pediatric study. In the adult study from the VA, they don't specifically assign a percentage, but they do report on page 4 the reasons for the wound dehiscence: 32% fascial tearing, 12% necrotic fascia, clearly a patient factor, 11% breakage of suture material, 9% intra-abdominal infection, 2% unraveling of sutures. And they further report that about 70% of those fascial closures were done by trainees. Unfortunately, we don't have a comparison group of patients who didn't have dehiscence, so we don't know what the comparable percentage of fascial closures that were intact done by trainees is. So there's limited data on preventability. However, this estimate of 30% or so is in the same ballpark as for other risk-adjusted outcome measures. So if you look at risk-adjusted mortality measures, the risk-adjusted complication measures that were discussed yesterday, I think that the empirical literature suggests that something between 20 and 50% preventability is the typical range that we see for risk-adjusted outcome measures. That pretty much comes with the territory. In terms of the issue of importance, the importance of this indicator, as it was originally endorsed by the NQF, was based not on the prevalence, but on the impact. So the average case, because of the tight way in which these cases are defined, based on return to the operating room, the average case that experiences this complication, in two fairly sophisticated case control analyses, incurred an extra 9 days in the hospital, an extra $40,000 in excess hospital charges, and a 10% excess risk of attributable mortality. So the argument is that although these events are uncommon, they're very serious events that have profound implications for the patient care and for the healthcare system. So I think that addresses the issue of importance, preventability, and the coding issue.
What happens to those patients who are like trauma or, in my case, ruptured aneurysms, who wind up with abdominal compartment, who get opened at the bedside, but not for dehiscence reasons, but because you need to relieve the intra-abdominal pressure?
This code is specific for a situation where the wound is disrupted, where the wound opens up spontaneously after surgery, and the patient has to go back to the operating room to have that defect fixed. So it would not apply to a compartment syndrome kind of situation, because in that case there may be some leakage, but there's not a spontaneous fascial dehiscence that's occurring.
Just to respond to Dr. Romano's comment about the studies that showed the mortality and the assessment, yes, there is an association. All the literature supports that. The problem with those studies is that, as noted in the original study in 89, this is
and also in the pediatric study, a very high percentage of these are associated with some other process, usually an intra-abdominal infection. Therefore, and this is one of the big issues we see in the administrative data set tied to economic factors, is yes, wound disruption and requiring a closure does add to hospital cost, length of stay and cost. However, the vast majority of the time in the literature and in those studies that it was cited, there was a secondary or probably the primary cause of the disruption was an intra-abdominal infection or intra-abdominal catastrophe, which then is the primary reason why the patient has increased length of stay and cost, and the secondary coding of the dehiscence was partly associated with it. It's a coordinated confounder that goes with it. They move together. And to assume that this is the best marker is probably a false statement.
I would agree with that. I think what you're saying is that this is really a surrogate for something else that's going on. And should a measure be intra-abdominal, deep intra-abdominal infection associated with the procedure, that might get you more bang for the buck. From a surgeon's standpoint, that's really... When we stand up at M&M and say we had a wound dehiscence, the first question everybody says is, well, what caused it? That's what they want to know. It's not that there was a dehiscence, but what was the underlying cause for that? So I think in that sense it's important. And then the other question I would have for Dr. Romano is, since this measure has been endorsed, do you have any evidence that it's made any difference in patient care and outcomes?
And that's an important question. Dr. Romano, do you have a response?
Yes. So, the I can pull up the national numbers. I know that some individuals around this table have been involved in local efforts to address this problem, and so I can't speak to those efforts. I will say that the other factor, the risk adjustment model for this indicator does include heart failure, hypertension, chronic lung disease, obesity, anorexia or weight loss, and alcohol-related conditions. So many of the conditions that are associated with poor tissue are included and have the expected effects in the risk adjustment model, as well as, of course, age and some underlying abdominal pelvic conditions. Also, to address another question that was raised, there was a linkage study that was done with NISQIP. It was reported, it is one of the studies that was cited in the submission. It was in HSR a few years ago. In the NISQIP linkage study, we did find that about 35% of the events were missed. So there was some proportion of the cases that were missed based on linkage with NISQIP. Now, admittedly, the definitions are a little bit different, so we couldn't drill down to the finest level in terms of whether those cases that were missed in the PSI that were picked up by NISQIP, what was the nature of those cases, we can't say. And finally, again, I refer you to the paper from the VA that's in front of you that comments on some of the associated conditions, and 43% of the events were associated with evisceration of abdominal contents, 28% had fluid draining from the wound, 13% had some coughing or physical exertion that may have triggered the dehiscence. Wound infection was only found in 9%, and only 3 patients with a perforated hollow viscus. So at least in this series, it was a relatively small number that had a wound-related infection. Although certainly I concede the point that this is to some extent a marker of more serious things that may be going on.
If I can jump in for 1 second, this is John Bott with ARC. So, and this is a question we've been asked in past steering committees, have we seen an improvement as a result of the use of the measure? And our budget and our focus for ARC, for the Quality Indicator Project, is developing and maintaining the quality indicators and improving them where there's opportunities. So that's what our focus is. And so when users have questions about the measures, being responsive to that, if they have suggestions for improvements or how they could be refined, we catalog that and prioritize and act on those. Our our focus has not been the cataloging and tracking so much of how people have used them and where, but to be responsive to what their concerns are to continue to improve the measures. So we did complete, of course, the application, this NQF form, and it does ask who's using them, and we put in there who we were aware of that we're readily aware of by people contacting us, but we have not canvassed the many groups who use the measures to understand the way in which they've made an impact. Now, it's not to say that can't become an aspect of ARC's future work in supporting the indicators, but that, of course, is the resources we currently do not have to in the quality indicator project.
I did pull up the national trend data, which shows a decrease from 3.2 per 1,000 cases in 1994. At the advent of the quality indicator program, it was 2.62, and the most recent data are 2.48. So it suggests a modest downward trend, but I would, of course, be reluctant to attribute that to the use of this indicator.
One comment is that I agree with Bob that this is probably a surrogate measure. It's looking at other processes of care that impact the outcome of seeing a dehiscence. And I liken it a lot to someone having a temperature. We're not sure exactly what's going on, what's the reasoning behind the temperature, but it allows you to kind of dig in a little deeper and see what's going on. Utility for these PSIs are clearly around the fact that they're readily available. You search where there is light, and all of these different measures are actually fairly easy to obtain, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think they've been endorsed by a lot of the public state public reporting agencies around quality, and this one is probably maybe not the strongest of the bunch for the PSIs, but I think there's some utility to having these things available, where there are a lot of hospitals that don't have NIST, that don't have registries, but they can get this sort of data through the PSIs pretty readily available through the billing information. And then you can kind of dig in and see what's going on.
Yeah, but that should be the institutional's M&M process rather than at the sort of the national level. I guess one thing I would say is that I think it's very important that if we're going to support a metric, that it's a meaningful metric. And obviously that presents a challenge here. I will propose perhaps an idea, at least on the pediatric one, since there is so little data to support it. One thing that I would ask that we could consider if the NQF is amenable to it would be to have AHRQ, NACRI, and NSQIP, the PEDS NSQIP process, get together and take a look at this as a true outcome measure in terms of quality, and the PEDS NSQIP will start having data in about 6 more months, so there is the possibility that we could combine forces before considering this as a metric that should be passed. That's just a consideration.
Any other comments or thoughts?
Just two other comments. Just thinking about it and thinking about it more as I think what most of us as surgeons think about this as being a surrogate marker. I really liken this to the IHI trigger tool, where you go through a chart and you see you're trying to find out about hypoglycemia, so you actually look through the pharmacy records for how many amps of D50 were given during a period of time, and then you go through the chart and look to see what the reason for that was. And I really think that's how I see this, and I think that's how most of us use it at M&M on a daily basis. Now, granted, folks in private practice, depending on where they are, may not have a robust M&M, and so I think we also have to remember that those of us who are in academics, there is a whole other world out there, and how they use these indicators may or may not be valuable to them. So I think for a lot of us, we may have a bit of that bias. But that all of that being said, because I think it's clearly something to look at, but whether it should be an indicator that gets an official stamp, which then CMS and other folks may use as a pay-for-performance issue, is a whole nother target. And again, that's what I kind of want to keep us all thinking about is, when we put a stamp on something from the NQF that has some say in the real world, and these things then tend to get picked up by other groups, Leapfrog and CMS, et cetera. So I really think it's something to think about.
I mean, that's the big issue here. The difference between trigger tools and IHI is it's internally done and developed. Using this as a safety indicator, is it truly a marker of safety? That's a very different thing than, you know, and I would submit that there hasn't been any significant association with this marker because it is so infrequent that hospitals rarely ever do anything with it. And I can say in our practice, you know, looking over, you know, 100,000 operations a year, this is so low a frequency event that we can't do anything with it. So it just is there. And so it's not meaningful.
Any other comments? All right. So basically, to sum up, we talked about how this is a patient safety measure, so therefore it should be a rare event, but it's really more focused on impact on the patient rather than prevalence, and that seems appropriate. But on the other hand, that it doesn't seem to really be preventable or actionable for the most part. And Richard brought up the excellent point that central line infections were not deemed preventable or actionable previously. But still, I think that's the overlying opinion of the group, that these aren't really, for the most part, preventable or actionable. So the implications for patient safety may be pretty modest, but the implications for provider, for potentially negative provider sequelae may not be quite as modest. I think that something else that came out of this discussion that we could potentially recommend to NQF is that measure developers who would like for measures to be maintained provide support for the impact of the measure since the time that it was previously endorsed. So basically providing a little more data about the actual impact. And I think that we should consider charging the developers with this. It seems like the appropriate place to put that responsibility. And then the developers can figure out best how to do that within their resources. If there is anything else, if anybody feels like their point was not summarized here, please speak up and then we'll move on to the vote.
I'll say one other thing for the developers. If you're going to cite literature, it's very important to cite it correctly. And that really turned the argument on this was, it's, you know, the level of, you know, we're reading this, I know it's a lot to put it through, but if you want us to read it, then it's got to be accurate, and this was blatantly not accurate.
I would like to apologize for the misleading presentation of that evidence in the submission. It was not an intentional effort to mislead the panel, again, I tried to provide the best and most current papers here for your review. So I apologize for that.
Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the vote then. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? Just so everybody's aware, this is a pediatric measure, 367. I said yes, 14 said no. Now we need to provide a reason for maintenance measures that we consider, that we deem not important, correct?
We're not talking about this one in terms of having it go
inactive.
Okay. So we'll stop here since we're not really talking about inactive or emeritus or Hall of Fame status. So we'll move on to voting on 368, and this is the adult measure, unless anybody has anything else to add. Okay.
That's a question. Just it would be helpful because this is a contradiction of a previous NQF endorsement panel. So I think it'll be important for the record to state clearly why it's no longer considered important.
We had our discussion. This will be transcribed and posted. Is there more that we should say about that? I mean, it would just basically I'd be relisting the discussion that we just had.
We will have all of the information written up in the context of the measure regarding the discussion.
I suspect it would probably be grounded in 1C around the outcome or the evidence in terms of the evidence for the measure focus being in question in terms of the link of the measure to the outcome of interest. But again, we can clean that up a bit.
Okay. Let's go ahead and vote on the adult measure. Are you ready, Jessica? Okay. So we're voting on the adult measure now. Importance to measure and report. Okay, we're going to do a show of hands. This is the last vote for today.
Here it is.
Oh, here we go. Okay, 6 votes for yes, 13 votes for no. Let's open the phones for public and member comment. Regarding this last portion. Anybody on the telephone? Okay, the last section we are going to be talking about at 1:30. And Dr. Torchiana is going to take over here. We just want to make sure all of our developers are available.
So the 1:30 topic is under attachment 6, related and competing pediatric and congenital cardiac surgery measures. So when Arden and I were talking earlier today, we hoped that we would get to this topic before 1:30. And the question is, do we have our developers here? There's Dr. Jacobs from STS is here. We're Kathy Jenkins from Children's Hospital of Boston. On the telephone? Kathy, are you on the telephone? Not as yet. And then there's an AHRQ developer, Patrick. So we have a choice of waiting 4 minutes. Or we could have the children's developer go last, assuming she comes on by 1:30. Why don't we do that rather than flipping the agenda around?
Well, I wonder, only from the standpoint of everybody hearing all of the parts of the discussion, if maybe we can do just a couple minutes on this GAPS document that's the very last item on the agenda. Would that be okay?
Well, that's what we had discussed doing. My thought was if we asked the STS and HRQ to basically describe the rationale behind their measures, that hopefully by that time we would have filibustered up to 1:30 and we would have our children's representative on the phone. Is it possible she's on the phone and muted?
Operator, can you please check if Dr. Kathy Jenkins is perhaps on the non-speaking line?
She's not on the line.
She's not. Okay, I'll fold my tent. Let's do the other.
Sorry.
Do you want to introduce this one?
Yes. So, in the materials that you received for this meeting, and I'm referring to the document that had the 9 attachments, there is attachment number 8. I don't know if we can... Alexis, are you going to be able... Okay, good. And all this is just a little bit of an introduction to this. That's all I want to do, to have you take a look. One of the items that we are doing with each of the steering committees as they look at their area of assignment is asking them also to look at it in terms of where there might be gaps in measurement. And so what this document provides to you down the left side are a list of the surgery measures that are currently NQF endorsed. And the yellow highlight focuses on those measures that are in consideration in the work you're doing right now. So you can see the ones you're working with right now and the remainder of the N2F endorsed surgery-related measures. And then across the top of it, what we've done is identify different domains of care or service within which you might consider whether or not there should be a measure. And all that we are asking that you do, and not do it today, but to take a look over this and identify where you believe, either in the current topic areas or you can add additional topic areas across these domains where we should look for additional measures at some point in time.
Linda, could I ask you where the domains were defined?
If you're looking, are you looking at where the definitions appear on here, or?
No, I'm just curious that so many outcomes measures are under care coordination and management since there is no outcomes domain.
In the discussion of work done with the National Priorities Partnership, and some of the work that's been done with the new group looking at measurement, they have identified and defined, to some extent helps us in identifying where topic areas sit within the domains. Helen, is there anything?
Most of this corresponds to the domains in the recently released National Quality Strategy. So this does relate to that. I'm not sure patient report outcomes are there per se, but those relate quite well to the domains that the Secretary recently promulgated.
So this is a homework assignment. So if you would take that away, take a look at it when you have an opportunity and provide us some feedback.
Peter, I wonder if you want to mention the pediatric surgery discussion you and I had recently.
I can. It's still embryologic, but we will convene we'll discuss with NQF and take these surgical measures and focus them on the 18 and under population with a group of multi-specialty surgeons, and we'll take a look at ones that we think should be then brought forward as potential measures within the children's surgical care. Yes. And we've been trading, the NQF lists, and we'll start to focus on those.
So part of the idea there was to see how many of the measures that are labeled as adults are labeled as adults just because that's what the developer did and wasn't really thoughtful and could consider whether, in fact, if you look, some of those measures could be applicable to children as well with some adaptations. So I just want to let you guys know that's happening as well.
There's a lot of these, or many of these, have anesthesia implications. There are no specific anesthesia or pain management measures in here, and so I need to think about it a little bit, but you'll get some from us as well.
Hi, I'm Silver on the line. Hello?
Yes, Dr. Silver?
Hi.
Hi. So we're just finishing up one other quick discussion. So that's the GAPS work for you, please. Thank you very much. And we've not identified a deadline, but would appreciate it whenever you can do that for us.
Would you like for people to comment call or to communicate with them?
If you just send it back to either me or Alexis or Jessica, then we'll compile it all and give it back to the committee as a whole.
So, Melinda, just to make sure, this is Terry. Hello. This is consistent with my past academic experience. I just want to make sure about the assignment. I see.
I bet you always made A's.
Yeah. I'll just let that one go. So we're going to review again the initiatives that we've looked at for the past day and a half, and see whether in these new gap areas there are some issues that we may have missed and that we should want to consider. And in those, we mark a box. Plus minus a comment, is that what you're asking?
Right, except I think it's a little more simple in terms of we're not asking that you go back and take a look at the specifications of those measures, the topic areas. So are there any topic areas that we should now be looking for measures to fill gaps? Thank you.
So, Melinda, would you like us to start with the pediatric measures, or should we go to the failure to rescue measures?
I guess this is my moment of confusion, one of many. We had the discussion about the failure to rescue measures, so discussion about them will be the next discussion about the failure rescue measures related and competing, which we are not taking up today. The only ones that we're taking up today in terms of related and competing are the PEDS measures in terms of the ones that are related and competing. So that is measure PCS 1809, which is STS measure 2109, which is Children's Hospital Boston, and 339, this is the mortality measures, which is ARC measure, and then the related volume measures.
That's the question. A little bit of confusion because I have a bit of a window. We have scheduled an hour. I thought that I was calling back in today about my FTR measures because of an issue of distinguishing them between the original, which is my measures, and the ARC measure. I'm not going to be specific because otherwise I don't know if you need me on the call.
I think we won't need you on the call today, Dr. Silver.
Okay. Is this because it's being rescheduled or because it's... or they're already endorsed and it isn't an issue?
Dr. Silver, the discussion about them with respect to related and competing will be scheduled with this committee at a later point. It will be a conference call, and we will notify all of the developers and invite and be certain we have them available for that discussion.
Okay.
Thank you.
hold for just 1 minute. Is there an issue? So I guess it's just not today. Okay, we didn't understand, and sorry to bother you then. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so the next section is attachment 5, related and competing measures. We have three developers. Melinda has outlined the three measures that we're here to discuss. So we'll begin with the developers. Let's start with STS. And I would ask just to sort of establish the format of what we hope to accomplish in the next hour, that we'd like to begin with each of the developers describing their measures. We would ask that you refrain from any comments on the competing measures during that preliminary step. We then would ask that the committee discuss the various measures and discuss the issues raised with the goal that as we get through this conversation, we will be able to help define issues that we might ask the developers to return with around data, evidence, or modifications so that this can be brought to closure in a subsequent conference on the telephone. So let's start with the developers, Dr. Jacobs, for the STS measures.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Jacobs. I'm the chair of the STS Congenital Heart Surgery Database. And the background for this discussion is based on the fact that in pediatric heart surgery, there's a vast array of operations, each one of those operations being done in limited amounts. So unlike adult heart surgery, where you have hundreds of thousands of coronary bypass grafting operations or aortic valve replacement or mitral valve replacement, in pediatric heart surgery, there's over 100 basic types of operations that are done on the hearts of children. And the risk ranges tremendously from one operation to the next, and there's not high volumes of any of those operations. So in order to assess the mortality after congenital heart surgical operations, a methodology is needed to assess the complexity of the operation performed. And the measure that we propose is based on a tool called the STS-EACTS Congenital Heart Surgery Mortality Categories. What we did was we pulled data from the STS database and our counterpart database in Europe, the EACTS database, that was gathered using identical nomenclature and terminology. And based on that pool of data, we had access to over 75,000 pediatric heart surgery operations that were divided into 148 major operative procedures. Those were then analyzed and grouped into five categories or buckets of increasing operative complexity set up in a way to maximize the ability to discriminate between one category and the next category and to maximize the similarities within any given category. And what we then had was a tool that had five categories of complexity, with complexity one being operations that are the least likely to result in mortality, and complexity five, operations that are most likely to result in mortality. And in category one, mortality is around 0.5 to 1%, and in category five, mortality is over 20%. By having these five categories, one can then report mortality using similar categories that allow for meaningful comparison between institutions. STS feels it's very important to use a tool that functions in a clinical database rather than assessing outcomes after pediatric heart surgery from administrative data because of multiple publications that document the flaws in coding of congenital heart lesions utilizing ICD-9 codes in administrative data. And the one example I would give for that is the most talked about and focused upon operation in pediatric heart surgery that's used to assess programmatic performance is the Norwood operation. This is an operation that has between 15 and 25% mortality after the operation. So 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 babies who have this operation do not survive and die before they go home. And in a clinical database, like the STS database or other clinical databases, there's a procedure called the Norwood operation, so you can code for it. If one wants to find the Norwood operation from an administrative database, one would have to create an amalgamation of inclusionary and exclusionary criteria based on 15 different ICD-9 codes, some of which are required, some of which you cannot have, some of which you can have. And it's amazing to me that based on this amalgamation of 15 different codes, one can even identify this operation. That's one example of the weakness of administrative coding. So I think what we've tried to do through STS is create a system to stratify operative complexity that can be used both in clinical and administrative databases, but we emphasize that we feel that it should be done with administrative data, with clinical data, because of the flaws of coding pediatric heart surgical operations with administrative data. And I think I don't want to take any more time right now. I think that's a pretty rapid summary of the way our methodology works and how we apply it.
Thank you, Dr. Jacobs. Do we have Dr. Jenkins on the phone now?
Yes, this is Dr. Jenkins.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes, I'm here. I'm on the call.
Great. Could you describe your measure, the Children's Hospital measure?
Sure. The measure that we propose through this entire process is known as GRACT1. It was developed a number of years ago, and it's been widely used recently over the last 8 years or so. It's probably the most commonly used measure of mortality in the United States and across the globe. What we've heard through this entire process is a lot of questions about what's preferable about our methodology over some of the other methodologies that have been put forward. And let me just speak to that specifically. I think it's important to say that we've put forward our methodology as it was originally developed and validated years ago as a methodology that can be used in administrative data, which has been, there's been a lot of conversation about that use, as well as non-administrative data. And I think that's important for the committee to know. In fact, one of the reasons that we went forward with our pure RACT methodology, even though there was already the ARC methodology that had been approved previously, was the fact that the prior ARC methodology was put forward in a slightly different version than the way our measures had previously been developed and validated in terms of the additional risk factors that were incorporated for some reason that I believe related to some internal ARC harmonization, but was different than the way the measure had been done. And also, because the original ARC methodology only specified the use of the methodology in administrative data and did not incorporate the use of the methodology in non-administrative data. So what we've put forward is a measure that includes risk categories for procedural complexity as well as additional risk factors wrapped up together in a multivariate model that yields an SMR for institutional performance and covers, in general, roughly 85% to 92%, 93% of an entire pediatric case mix across most case mixes. In terms of our, and I will say something in response to the specific issue that Jeff Jacobs brought up about weaknesses of administrative data based on ICD-9 codes. While it's definitely true that there are not good ICD-9 codes to detect surgical procedure for Norwood Stage 1, there's an excellent ICD-9 code for the diagnosis, which is HLHS. And so the algorithms that have been built to detect those specific procedures have in general worked out pretty well. And every data set I've ever looked at using RACT1 the category for the Norwood-type procedures, which is the highest risk category, has always had a mortality rate that was distinctly higher than and distinctly different than any other of the other categories. So I don't think there's a lot of problems with identifying those procedures, at least in the sense that the category is finding procedures of especially high mortality. I would like to say something about weaknesses with the by-category mortality rate that I believe is also being proposed as part of this conversation, just so the committee is aware of them. First of all, when we talk about by-category mortality, whether we talk about it by RAC-1 or the new SDS category or a prior version of Aristotle category, the categories in general work well for the procedural complexity. The problem is that you take a case mix, which is typically around 200 or 250, maybe 300 cases, and you divide it up into 5 or 6 categories. And as everyone knows, what you've done then is you've essentially distorted and diluted any statistical power to make any meaningful comparison, because the confidence limits around the by-category mortality rates are really rather very large, even in large institutions. So almost by definition, from statistical power alone, you've diluted your ability to find meaningful differences. And in addition, not surprisingly, those categories then don't account for other clinical risk factors, like the age of the patient and whether they have other anomalies and whether the infant is premature. And so the categories alone really don't account for all of the variation. In general, the categories will give an area under the ROC curve somewhere in the range of 0.7. Easy additional risk factors to bump it up along beyond that. So it's a combination of the small sample sizes in typical pediatric case mixes and the fact that there are procedural complexity variables beyond procedure that make it much better to wrap up the entire measure into an SMR that brings all of that together and has statistical power.
Dr. Jenkins, could you wrap up your description?
That was the end of my comment.
Thank you so much. Who will speak for HRQ? Patrick?
I will. Yes, this is Patrick Romano again. So this is easy for me because I think we're very clear and direct that this HRQ indicator is based on the work of Kathy Jenkins and her colleagues at the Children's Hospital of Boston. And so we defer to them regarding the specific issues in the application of the RACS methodology. It's based on the same RACS methodology. So the different, of course, you know, in terms of the process by which this became an ARC quality indicator, fundamentally, ARC and its contractors control the field looking for quality indicators that can be applied to administrative data sets. And Kathy Jenkins' work, of course, came to the attention of AHRQ. It's in the public domain, and we actually had a number of conversations with Dr. Jenkins and her colleagues about the specific operationalization of the indicator. So there are some differences, which are really technical differences that relate to how the indicator is presented. So Kathy described the construction of an overall SMR, a standardized mortality ratio, kind of an observed to expected ratio. The ARC quality indicator software spits out a risk-adjusted mortality rate, which is simply an SMR multiplied by some overall average mortality rate, so it converts it into a percentage. The other differences relate to the risk adjustment. Those could easily be reconciled. Fundamentally, I think both approaches adjust for the RACS categories that Kathy's mentioned. They adjust for age and birth weight or prematurity. The adjusters in the ARC model are slightly different because they come out of a
certain risk adjustment structure that's embedded into all of the ARC quality indicators. For example, there's a specific indicator for patients who are transferred in the ARC model to account for the fact that some of those patients may be higher risk in ways that aren't directly captured elsewhere in the risk adjustment. So those minor differences could be reconciled. The final point that I want to make just to the general issue is that there's been quite a bit of experience, I think, with this measure, both with Zach Jenkins' team and others. And in fact, there was a comparative study, O'Brien and Clark. It was a head-to-head study that basically showed that these two approaches, the STS-based approach, the RASP-based approach, are functionally equivalent in terms of discrimination, in terms of the ability to discriminate between kids who die and kids who survive the hospitalization. So from the statistical standpoint, it's very hard to discern a meaningful difference in the performance. The fundamental difference is that one indicator is based on a registry system, which is very important for quality improvement, and the Children's Hospital of Boston and our measure, the ARC measure, are based on administrative data.
Comments from the committee?
Do you have a, since we didn't get to review your measure, it's clearer in the Children's Hospital measure that they're looking at the low-risk patients, it seems to me, because they're saying RASC 1 risk category. But it's not clear in yours how you discriminate between severity of disease.
It's the same, actually. The RASC is a five-level scoring system, and so those the RASC categories are put into a multivariable risk adjustment model. So each of the categories carries a certain additional risk that's associated with it. I believe, Dr. Jenkins, I believe, is that the same approach that you use?
Absolutely, yes.
So, do you report it by category?
The ARC measure reports it as an overall composite in the same way. It's just the only difference is that the Children's Hospital of Boston reports it as a ratio of observed to expected, and the ARC software translates that into a risk-adjusted mortality rate. Users can, of course, drill down and look at the stratum-specific mortality rates for each of the five RASC levels, but, of course, that's more difficult for consumers, purchasers, payers, other stakeholders to understand. So the preferred measure from the standpoint of ARC's stakeholders is the composite measure.
What are the metrics for your composite measure? What are the units?
It's the risk-adjusted mortality percentage.
So it's, I'm sorry, that's what I'm getting at, it's just a straight percentage.
Yes, it's derived by the ratio of the observed to expected multiplied by the overall mean average. Yeah. So it's a standard approach for what we call indirectly standardized mortality rates.
Here, I think it's a composite in that it's a composite of all risk levels.
Right, because the STS results in five. You get a score for each of the five levels.
Yeah, and the rationale for that is that imagine you're a mother with a child that has the highest level complexity patient. You might want to be able to find out how a given center performs caring for patients of that level of complexity, and that might not be possible if you just get an overall aggregate score. So it was felt that it's important for patients and patients' families to be able to access how a given institution performs both in the low levels of complexity and in the high levels of complexity.
And I guess you feel that your model, your risk adjustment model, accounts for case mix by its risk adjustment.
Well, it does account for case mix. I can't argue with Dr. Jacobs' point. It's just that different stakeholders have different needs. And so some might prefer to see a single measure that's specific to a certain risk level. Others will prefer to see a composite measure that incorporates both low and high risk patients and adjusts for the difference. But again, his physical performance is very comparable.
So it seems to me that yours and the Children's Hospital are very similar, just a different way of reporting the same data, whereas the STS has a distinct purpose. So to my mind, it's really comparing the ARC and the Children's Hospital, because it seems to me that the STS database is reporting it in a different way. They're reporting by category so people can actually see by category, by risk, you know, by the severity of disease.
Right, and in fact, from what I understand, there's a strategy both to deal with competing measures and complementary measures, and it might be viewed that while the ARC and the RACS are competing measures, the STS measure could be viewed as a complementary measure because it's taking a fundamentally different approach to provide access to a different type of information.
I think that's potentially a way forward, but I guess I'd say this is very reminiscent of a long conversation we had yesterday, with apologies to the developers who weren't in that conversation, but this is quite similar to the aortic aneurysm repair conversation in that there's a sort of tension between adding things together and getting more ability to discriminate at the institutional level versus splitting them up into more appropriate, more homogeneous groups. That then thereby then lose some ability to discriminate. And I do think it's not unreasonable to think of that as complementary rather than competing. Could I ask Dr. Jacobs the plans or current status of the reporting this to the public, if this is for families? Is this reported to the public currently by the participating STS institutions, or is that a future plan?
So as some people in this room probably are aware, the STS has moved forward with public reporting of cardiac surgical outcomes fairly aggressively in the past year. And the approach we took, I can speak to quite a large amount of detail because I chair the public reporting task force for the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. And what we decided to do was initially to report from the adult cardiac surgery database CABG outcomes. And we've been doing that for just about a year now. And we wanted to work out the kinks of public reporting of cardiac surgical outcomes using the CABG outcomes first, but that's really a platform that will then be expanded in adult cardiac also to aortic valve and mitral valve, and in our other databases will be expanded to both thoracic and congenital. So our intent is to do just like we did with the CABG outcomes and to publicly report these outcomes as well. Using similar strategies, and I think that's something that's going to happen quite soon.
At what level are you reporting those outcomes? Provider level, facility level, group level?
So the CABG outcomes are reported both at group level and facility level. So one can go to the STS website and see the CABG outcomes for a given hospital or a given surgical group. Up till now, the decision has been made not to report it based on an individual provider, based on the concept that outcomes after heart surgery are dependent on so many elements of the team and not just the surgeon independently. One can say heart surgery is a team sport, not an individual sport. And based on that, so far we've reported it at the group level and at the hospital level.
Can I ask a question about the data? Oh, I'm sorry, Terry, go ahead. Dr. Jacobs, in the data you've gathered, what does it show about breaking the cases down into five different categories? Do you find centers that are good at simple operations and bad at hard ones, and
absolutely,
vice versa?
You find several things. First of all, you find that this methodology has the ability to identify outliers even though you've broke it into five separate strata or categories. So we don't need to pool all the data together to identify outliers. Outliers can clearly be identified in each of the five categories. Second of all, we found that there's centers that don't perform surgery at all in the most complex category. So there's centers that don't even do Category 5 surgery, but instead they refer the patients elsewhere. And if one pools all the data together to create one score, then when one looks at that score, it's impossible to know whether or not that center is performing the high complexity surgery. So, not only can you identify outliers within each category, but you can also, with this methodology, identify centers that don't perform the high complexity surgery at all.
I'm speaking hopefully for the committee to be reminded what our specific responsibility is today and what the impact of that might be. That is, if we are asked to make a decision, do one or two of these go away, or what happens?
I don't think we're being asked to make a decision today. We talked about that at lunch with amongst this end of the table. The goal is to try to have a fruitful discussion to give feedback to the developers and I think to identify modifications or additional information that might help lead us to a future decision, but the decision is not to be made today.
Thank you. Then I would like to make one comment. Having played in both the arena of administrative data and clinically derived data, recognizing the complexity of this specific issue and also paying homage to the seriousness and commitment of all players involved in all three of these, I would have to err on the side of going with a clinical database for this kind of process. And to the extent that that kind of conversation can take place between and amongst, that's great. If not, then I would bend on the side of the clinical database in an ongoing quality measurement process.
We heard yesterday the penetrance of SCS for adult hospitals was pretty high. It was like 95%. Curious about the penetrance of SCS for pediatric cardiac hospitals.
Right. So, that's an excellent question. And STS has done several manpower surveys, and based on those manpower surveys, we estimate that there's 122 hospitals in the United States that do pediatric and congenital heart surgery, and that estimate has been validated through other sources of data as well. Right now, STS receives data from 98 of those 122, and if we look at the 20 largest by volume, we get them all. And if we look at the 20 that are listed in the U.S. News and World Report as the centers of excellence, we get data from 19 of those, and the 20th, I think, is going to start sending this year. So it's. I think the penetrance of the STS database is fairly high. The ones that we're missing are low-volume programs, and we're making every effort to encourage those low-volume programs to participate as well.
Could I just ask, I'm sorry, what percentage have agreed to public reporting of those data that are being contributed?
Right, that's a good question. So right now we haven't even asked the congenital heart surgery database yet because that initiative hasn't started. In the adult heart surgery database, last year was the first year that we did public reporting. As most people know, it was done on a voluntary basis. And in year one, we had 20% of the programs participate and publicly report their data. Now, in year two, that number is up to 39% right now. So going from 1 year to the second year, we've already doubled the participation, essentially. And I think that it'll continue to climb. As long as it's voluntary, I doubt it's ever going to get to be 100, but the fact that we doubled it from year one to year two tells me that more and more places will do it. And if enough people do it, it becomes functionally mandatory.
This is Kathy Jenkins. I'd just like to make one more comment so people are aware of it, that in response to Patrick Romano's earlier comment about the ease of harmonizing our methodology with the ARC methodology, I had proposed that very early in this process, and through the NQF rules, we had been told that we weren't really allowed to bring things together at this stage. So
I think that actually only had to do with this is Helen Getty, because this measure was in a different project, but I think now that we've actually sort of brought them somewhat together, I think those options are completely on the table.
And I would just like to reiterate our willingness to do that.
I think from STS point of view, it seems to me that it would be, first of all, very nice to see the AHRQ and the Boston Children's Measure harmonized, and I think that ultimately STS would view that as a favorable move, and hopefully STS would also be supportive of seeing a harmonized AHRQ RACS measure and the STS measure ultimately both being endorsed as complementary measures, because I think from the discussion that we've heard today, each measure brings some very nice features to the table. And then we could have two complementary measures, a harmonized measure of AHRQ and RACS and a complementary STS measure. And that's something that the database would be very supportive of.
That conversation, Jeff, though, because as I said before, our methodology was originally validated in a registry, which is not the STS registry, but the Pediatric Cardiac Care Consortium registry, which is very similar. And so I don't see any reason why an SMR using the RACS methodology, using a clinical registry, is STS is not also a possible measure that could be useful publicly.
I that's exactly what I said. I think that I would be very supportive of that happening, and I think it could be viewed as a complementary measure to what STS is proposing. So I think both of them together are additive rather than competitive.
Could I ask for input from the committee on that question, the notion of having complementary registry and administrative data coexisting?
I think that they both bring separate things together that are equally important.
Well, the problem that you have to be careful of is that we don't get confusing information. And you know, I'll cite the difference between UHC and NSQIP type data right now, which are, you know, 180 degrees opposite. And so the last thing you want is this idea is some mother looking up, well, wait a minute, this number says good, and this number says not so good. What do I do? So the question I have is, if you rolled up all your STS data, has anybody looked at the correlation between a unified measure of your overall STS results and how it might correlate with the administrative studies, the RAC study, or with the HRQ?
Well, I think that all three of these methodologies can be applied to administrative data or registries. And the reason that I said that they were complementary was not because administrative data and clinical data is complementary, but because what the STS does with the STS categories is somewhat different from what the RACS and AHRQ methodologies do. And I think there's value to having both pieces of information. There's value to having the individual outcomes of the five categories at a given program, and there's value to having the overall composite. And that's why I think they're both complementary. It's not a complementary nature of clinical or administrative data, because the clinical and administrative databases can function with any of these three tools. We've not rolled all five categories into one score, because we think there's value in having the information of each of the five categories the way we present that. However, that's something that could certainly be done if it was felt that that would be a beneficial part of the process as well.
And this is Kathy Jenkins. I understand the point of the question about confusion to the public. And I've never really specifically seen the exact academically done heads-up comparison that you're actually looking for, but having seen many reports from in various ways using both clinical databases as well as the administrative databases, I've never seen an especially confusing signal with that sort of one looks up and one looks down kind of a problem that you're alluding to. I don't think the problem here is really with the administrative versus clinical signal. We're really just talking about how to get the risk adjustment right so that it really adjusts for complexity across such a diverse case mix in a way where we can make sense of the information and have enough statistical confidence that there's clarity.
And if I could address that point. So, Ark, I think we defer to Dr. Jenkins in terms of her methodologic expertise in developing this measure. But let me just explain how the complementarity works to some extent. I think I can speak for AHRQ, even though I'm a contractor, in saying that the agency is very supportive of the STS registry and the development of outcomes measurement programs based on STS and other registries. But it is the availability of alternative measures based on administrative data that sometimes encourages people to participate in registries. So within certain local markets, users have the option of referring to either their local administrative data set or asking hospitals to join the STS. And so if it's understood in a local market that that purchaser coalitions, for example, will produce a report card based on the ARC measure, then what often happens is that hospitals voluntarily say, well, we'd rather release our data through the STS, and that's perfect. So if that alternative mechanism exists, then if anything, it tends to increase participation in the registry, and in the long run, the goal is to get information into the public domain that's useful to stakeholders. So I think we're all on the same page in terms of the pursuit of that goal, and having complementary measures is actually a way of furthering that goal.
And I think it's really important to have the complementary measures because, I mean, I've just looked up STS, and for Illinois we have 13 hospitals publicly reporting the CABG data. Well, 13 isn't very many of our hospitals that do the surgery. And, you know, if pediatric isn't even in the loop yet on public reporting, it's obviously going to be a while before that information is available to anybody except the hospital. So I think a measure that is available on a broader scale and that can be run on an administrative database that, you know, so everybody has the information is useful.
And one other question might be going forward, it would be really nice to be able to see the complementarity or the similarities and differences between the data sources. So I think it would also be very useful, for example, if STS began collecting and as part of the registry some of that key claims data so we can begin to make sense of those connections, which I know has not been traditionally part of the STS registry. But again, anything we can do to learn more about how these different resources can get us complementary and or contradictory information, I think would be really useful.
I had a question for the surgeon from Boston University Children's having to do with the RAC statistical risk model. Did I hear you say that that is used worldwide and it's the largest risk model used in pediatrics or pediatric surgery?
Well, that's certainly my experience and perspective. By the way, I'm not a surgeon. I'm a cardiologist. I'm also the Chief Safety and Quality Officer for the Children's Hospital in Boston. So I'm sure that Jeff and others might disagree. I'm not suggesting that the methodology used by STS and their sister organization in Europe, the EACTS, is not also widely used. But they all have required participation in registries. And in the United States, there was a survey that was done by a group of pediatric cardiologists about what was the preferable methodology, and three-quarters of the survey respondents actually chose the RAC methodology in the United States. And the methodology has been used in South America. It's being used in a very large developing world collaborative, which we're doing now for benchmarking in developing world countries, and it's been used by the Children's Hospital Corporation of America to generate reports internally across all the large children's hospitals. But I do think that the comment that it's been widely used is real.
So I don't want to cut off any productive discussion, but it seems like we've arrived at a point where there seems to be pretty strong consensus that these are potentially complementary measures, and that the ask that we would have ultimately, I think, was just described, that it would be great to see the STS measure in the public domain as that evolves, and B, that the two measures be used in a comparative way on registry and clinical data or administrative data to try to work out any kinks or irregularities. But otherwise, I think we're in, on pretty sound ground here, unless somebody wants to raise another issue.
Can I just make one very brief comment about, first of all, I agree with what you said. I think that's a fantastic plan moving forward. And I just wanted to have the opportunity to put into the record a few facts about the size and scope of the measure that we're proposing and its utilization. So the largest congenital heart surgery database in North America is the STS database. The largest congenital heart surgery database in Europe is the EACTS database. And both of those two large-scale databases have unanimously endorsed the method that we're proposing. Not only that, but when all of the surgeons on the STS database task force were asked which methodology would they prefer to move forward with, all of those surgeons on the STS database task force unanimously chose to endorse the measure that we proposed as a society. Now, that's to speak to the size, scope, and support behind our measure, but I do believe that these two approaches are very complementary and are additive rather than competitive.
The question's still going to be, though, that we still have to narrow this down from 3 to 2. Is that still not the ultimate goal?
I think part of what we heard is that ARC and Children's Hospital Boston will have some ongoing discussions, and I think we'll provide you the additional information as that goes forward, and then we'll see whether, you know, we'll lay it all for you and see if it all makes sense on an upcoming conference call.
So, may I just ask a question of the group? Anticipating further discussion on a future conference call, based on the fact that, one, you just got some background about how to assess related, competing, and you could say complementary as well, and you first heard the discussion of two of these measures, and as has been pointed out, you have not seen the documentation for two of the measures that you've seen of one. Are there materials that you would like to see to help better be informed to come to a point of recommendation, of suggestion about how to go forward? And do you have any other questions of the developers that you'd want to have answers to in preparation for a future discussion?
I guess I'd answer that by saying the ideal thing to see would be just a cross comparison of the two data sets on the same population with whatever level of detail is available. That's a pretty big project, but that obviously would be the most definitive contemporary way to look at the performance of the two data sets and determine how, to what degree they complement and to what degree they contradict.
I think the only group that could really do that is probably the STS, because the coding framework that they use isn't really used by anyone else.
My request would be simpler. I'd just like to see from the STS the bin size. So by facility, by category, how many cases do they have for a year or 2 years or 3 years?
That information has actually been published by STS in the Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery. So there's a manuscript that's referenced in the material that was distributed to the group that publishes that exact data.
David, what you're asking for, I think what we would want is, you know, for whatever a complementary or a year report is for, you know, 1, 2, and 3, which would allow us to compare institution to institution across the different reports. Is that correct?
I think when it comes to competing measures, that would obviously be as close as one can get to a gold standard. Now, to what degree that actually identifies the best in breed, I'm not sure. But it is, it has been done with the AHRQ measures in adult heart surgery against the STS measures. And it's useful information. It gives you an idea where they coincide and where they diverge.
I would agree. I think even if there'll be separate reports, but it would allow us as committee members to look at the type of or how the institutions are reported out and how to correlate those results.
I guess I'd say though that's a big project depending on what timeline we're on, and I feel fairly satisfied that these measures should be approved as complementary, but that work really would be very helpful.
Do we think that the AHRQ and the Children's Hospital should be essentially one?
I just want to remind everyone that the Children's Hospital measure was proposed for administrative and non-administrative data, as it was originally validated.
There are some procedures that National Quality Forum has, I think, with regard to the identification of measure stewards and how we would establish a co-stewardship that I think would have to be worked out, and I can't speak for the agency on that particular issue because there would have to be a specific agreement by which we would have joint responsibility for maintaining the measure and for keeping NQF up to date with respect to new evidence about the measure and changes in the indicator specification. One of the group advantages of administrative database measures is that the definitions have to be reexamined every year as new IC9 CM codes are introduced or removed. We're also looking forward to conversion to ICD-10 CM in October 2013. So all of these measures that use codes will have to be re-specified, and there'll be a lot of ongoing dialogue with NQF about that process. So in any case, we're happy to work with NQF and with Dr. Jenkins and her colleagues to bring these into a single measure, recognizing that there may be some temporal issues associated with the sort of legal issues and working out the software compatibility.
I guess I have more of a general question, and it's not related to these three measures specifically, but as we move forward, when a measure developer is submitting a new measure that may be a competing measure, are they required to submit a rationale for why they're submitting it? Because otherwise we're just going to see a proliferation, I think, of measures being submitted and having to make decisions.
Yeah, actually, our updated measure submission form requires, as a condition of submission, that you've looked in the NQF portfolio, you've identified what else there is. And in fact, we're actually going to have the advantage of being able to announce projects significantly advanced to the due dates. We will actually expect by the time it's submitted to us that the developers would have done the work of looking and harmonizing this. As you guys know, it just takes a long time, and doing it in the course of a project just delays things significantly. And we're also going to try to, as much as possible, let everybody else know we're working on some pipeline things as well, so people can go, we hope, ultimately somewhere to be able to say, these are the developers who are working in my space, and try to, as much as possible, work collaboratively.
Is there any move to make a global database that everybody can access various data pieces that fulfill everybody's needs? You understand what I'm saying? So there's a huge registry, basically. A huge registry of data. That everybody can, you know, use based on what everybody's needs are. So that, you know, everybody's access. Because the thing that keeps coming up is that everybody's data points are slightly different.
There's some of that work going on as part of the work NQF and others have been doing on something called the quality data model, where they've been trying to identify the key data elements that would populate electronic health records in particular, and we hope registry, to be able to ultimately do quality measures that we know we need and want. Part of that will ultimately be, and there's still some work being done to figure out where this will reside within HHS, of who would be the code set owners, which I think is part of what you're trying to get at. So if they're identifying these procedures this way, can somebody kind of take that same list the next time they're developing measures, so it's not this constant churning of figuring that out? That's really just starting. There is some interesting work, actually Patrick probably knows, some of this funded through ARC, actually by a group called USHIK, which actually does pull together a lot of the existing data and data sets to help do that.
So are they involving the societies or the various specialties? Because what keeps coming up from the different societies or the different specialties is that we on the clinical side view things a little bit differently than those on the administrative side. So, you know, to blend those two sides together in terms of a, you know, again, the idea to, one, make quality better and also to be able to give to the patient something that they can view and understand.
Certainly on the EHR side, a lot of that is happening. There's significant outreach to try to figure out what are those data elements that would be incorporated into EHRs going forward. But it's just beginning.
There's a movement afoot about trying to harmonize all the different surgical specialties, Surgery Quality Alliance, and been meeting for, I think, almost 5 years now in the hopes of creating, you know, a unified surgical database. Efforts have not been fruitful to date in terms of getting a single data set out.
ARC is working on a registry of patient registries right now that would look like, seriously, clinicaltrials.gov.
Department of Redundancy Department?
No. That would list all both quality management and research databases that existed, and it's at the white paper stage right now, so they really haven't gotten very far. But the idea would be you could drill into it, see what elements each registry is collecting, and see what data is out there.
And there's some great international examples like Sweden, where they actually have sort of done the registry of registries that pulls it together. That would be lovely.
Sweden has that massive database, and anybody can use, and they have like hundreds of data elements, so each society can pull from it and get whatever information that they want.
So all you need is the Swedish health system with a single government payer, and we're there. I think we've completed that agenda topic. I'd like to thank our developers, and I think we can move on to the next topic on the agenda. So that would be NPF member public comment if anyone is on the phone. Is there anyone on the phone and muted as there was yesterday? We're a little early, I guess. Okay, we'll go to Melinda for next steps and timeline.
So Alexis and I talked a bit earlier, and what we believe is that based on the fact that there is some information that you wanted to have back regarding some of the measures that were discussed, that we need to get that collated, get it out to the developers, let them provide the information back, much as was done with phase one, and give you the opportunity to review and react to whether or not the information that's provided meets your specifications, your conditions, and do that as step one in a conference call, and then soon thereafter follow up with the second conference call to have the discussion about related and competing measures. And related and competing measures from phase two, and we can close out the discussion on the one that you've just begun. So we will have to get you cleaned up versions of that table with related and competing that you looked at a bit earlier. So that'll be the second of two conference calls, the way that we've talked about in terms of volume of material to be covered to do, and we'll get out to you a request about time availability to do that in two calls. So that's next steps.
All right, so just in closing, I'd like to say thanks so much for all of your hard work and attention. I think everybody really contributed substantially to the meeting, and of course, we're not really done yet.
So there's more coming. But I'd like to basically to applaud the committee for all of the hard work and also the NCHA staff.
And I'd like to thank everybody for your patience with NQF processes and evolution here. We are trying to make it a stronger process, and we have been doing a little bit of flying it while, what's our expression, building it while flying it. So thank you for your input. And thanks to our chairs. Really great effort.